experience, fame, but I've become a cartoon character.
That's a mind that is driven simply by curiosity.
Having a large, diverse social network decreased our risk of death by 45%.
Thank you so much. It's been a journey.
BBC Radio 4. Listen on your smart speaker.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 7th of February. This is Tom Sanders. Good morning. The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he greatly regrets bringing Lord Mandelson back into government in 2008. Writing in The Guardian, Mr. Brown says there were no reports at the time of Lord Mandelson having a friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
In his article, Gordon Brown said he wanted to express his revulsion at what has been uncovered about Jeffrey Epstein and his impact on our politics. Mr. Brown writes that he gave Peter Mandelson a job in government in 2008 because he thought his unquestioned knowledge of Europe and beyond could help us as we dealt with the global financial crisis. I now know that I was wrong, he writes. I greatly regret this appointment. Emails released by the US government last week appear to suggest Lord Mandelson, who was business secretary, was sharing sensitive government information with Epstein while Mr. Brown was in number 10. Met police officers investigating claims of misconduct in public office offences carried out searches at Lord Mandelson's London home yesterday and a country house he uses in Wiltshire. The former Labour peer, who resigned from both the party and the House of Lords this week, has previously denied any wrongdoing. It's understood he believes he has not acted in any way criminally.
The Cabinet Office says it started handing out emergency interest-free loans to some of the thousands of recently retired civil servants who have not received their pensions. The PCS union, which represents many civil servants, has described the situation as catastrophic and is calling for urgent action from the government. The Cabinet Office and the firm running the pension scheme Capita say they're deeply sorry and have drafted in extra staff to put things right. Martin Kavanagh is the president of the PCS union.
It's catastrophic, absolutely catastrophic. I mean, I think most people would accept that this has been an administrative disaster, and people will not understand how any company or any employer could possibly get something so badly wrong.
President Trump has said that he did not see the section of a video posted on his social media account that depicted Barack and Michelle Obama as apes. After initially defending it, the White House removed it, saying a staff member had posted it by mistake. From Washington, Simi Jalaushow reports.
President Trump said he only watched the first part of the video that rehashed unproven claims of voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, so he didn't know about the offensive clip it included nearer the end. That part of the video depicted several high-profile Democrats as animals and received widespread condemnation, including from members of his own party. The video was later taken down. When asked whether he renounced portraying the Obamas as apes, Mr. Trump said, of course, but declined to apologise.
The Winter Olympics have officially begun in Italy, with the lighting of the cauldrons in Milan and Cortina taking place last night. A colourful, tightly choreographed opening ceremony was split across four locations, with live celebrations also in Livigno and Predazzo. The main event in the San Siro Stadium in Milan featured the Italian tenor singer Andrea Bocelli. Our correspondent Joe Curry was there.
The 25th Winter Olympics opened with a fitting celebration of sport and the arts. Mariah Carey stole the show with her rendition of the Italian classic Volare. Team GB's athletes, watched by Princess Anne, entered the San Siro wearing hats and scarves designed by the Olympic diver and keen knitter Tom Daly, and were led into the stadium by the ice skater Lila Fear. Later today, Team GB's curlers will look to maintain their unbeaten run in the mixed doubles, whilst Kirsty Muir goes in qualifying for the women's free ski slopestyle.
We'll have a look at the papers in a minute. First, the weather forecast with Simon King.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, everybody. Yeah, it's pretty cloudy again across many parts of the UK today. Further outbreaks of rain. But overall, over the weekend, there will be some drier spells. Just an opportunity to get out and about if you need to. So for today, across England and Wales, we've got some rain that's moving its way north and eastward through parts of South Wales and through the West Country this morning. Moving north and eastward, as I mentioned, it will tend to break up and turn into more showery rain this afternoon, and further showers follow it from the southwest. So for all of us this afternoon, showers scattered around, maybe a few drier, brighter spells from time to time. Temperatures getting to about 7 to 12 degrees. For Northern Ireland today, pretty cloudy this morning. Some outbreaks of rain continuing into the afternoon, but again, some drier spells, 8 or 9 Celsius. And for Scotland, well, cloudy, damp and drizzly to start off this morning. Still some hill snow over the Grampians. It might turn a bit drier into this afternoon, but remaining really quite cloudy for all, with maximum temperatures of 4 to 6 Celsius.
Simon, many thanks. Now for a look at the morning papers. The Daily Mail says that Scotland Yard swooped on Lord Mandelson's two homes as officers investigate claims of misconduct in a public office. The Mail reports that he was not arrested, but he may face questions from Metropolitan Police detectives in the coming weeks. The Sun opts for "Police rummage through Mandy's drawers" as its headline. According to the Daily Telegraph, the raids in London and Wiltshire were launched simultaneously yesterday afternoon. The paper says flashbulbs could be seen going off inside Peter Mandelson's home in Camden, suggesting that photographs were being taken. The Times has been told the former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner privately warned Sir Keir Starmer that appointing Lord Mandelson as ambassador to the United States would be a mistake. The paper reports that the Prime Minister is said to have ignored her warning and chose to believe Lord Mandelson's claim that he barely knew the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Deceit, betrayal and a scandal that demands historic change is the headline accompanying Gordon Brown's article in The Guardian. He describes the sexual trafficking plotted by Jeffrey Epstein as the most egregious example of a global network of wealthy and powerful men that thinks it can act with impunity. The Daily Express leads on a criticism of the decision to raise the BBC licence fee. Writing in the paper, the Shadow Culture Secretary, Nigel Huddleston, says that asking people to pay more for a service that's losing trust is not credible. The Daily Mirror's TV editor, Nicola Methven, points out that the rise is equivalent to another 46 pence per month. "We'd be lost without Auntie," she says. The Daily Star bemoans the state of the weather after forecasters revealed rain has fallen somewhere in the UK every day this year. "Things can only get wetter," is the Star's headline. That's our look at the papers this morning. Wagyu beef in Norfolk, young farmers in the Western Isles, and what effect will the goal of net zero have on farmers? Farming Today this week is at 5:30. But first, here's Claire Balding with this week's Ramblings.
What started out as a very, very grumpy, miserable day in Cumbria has brightened. It is smiling on us. The skies above are starting to lighten, and ahead of me I can see this great long lump of a bare hill, because we are in the Lake District. Some 900 and something square miles of pure beauty, and you could walk all day, every day, and not necessarily repeat your tracks. And I'm with a man who probably would do that if you could, Ian. Ian Teasdale and his wife Kath are here, and we're going to walk on a route that might not be as difficult as some that you take on, but it's definitely one that will give me, I think, a bit of a lift. Where are you taking me?
So today we're going to go up Longlands Fell, and then depending on how we're all feeling and whether the weather's nice, we'll carry on up onto Great Scaw Fell, and then down Millfell and back to the car.
If you do want to follow us on the map, we're on OS Explorer OL4, which is the English Lakes northwestern area. So we're in the North Lakes. Think of Keswick and go west from there. The grid reference is Longlands NY 266 358, and there's parking space for about four cars there. There was a lot of rain last night, and consequently the stream on the right-hand side is gushing fast and loud past us. We're walking on a wide cart track, it feels like. The farm buildings up to the left in the local stone, this end of it though painted white, and a lot of stone walls, the edges of which we can see between these trees. But that feeling of scale, it's so big. You know, I was trying to put into context how much you could walk here. And Ian, this is something you really love, and walking is very much a passion for you.
I think I've been walking in these hills now for 60 years. How can it have got to such a big number? But that's the truth of it. You can walk all your life here.
This walk is one that we used to do with our kids when they were little. And there's a big rock that we'll go past, that we've got a sort of classic photograph that you take once when they're tiny, standing on the rock. And then the next time we came back, we'd have them standing the same way, just watching them grow. So that's what this particular stretch means to me.
We're gaining height rapidly, but you can see the folds of the land and the way the wind has blown the grass like hair. You know when your hair naturally falls one way or the other? You look at that and go, big floppy fringe going to the left. So is this in where you grew up?
As we get higher, I'll be able to point out all the places I grew, but I grew about 8 miles that way. But more significantly, these hills are the hills of my ancestors. Most of my family on the Teesdale side of things were sheep farmers. Longland Farm here and all the farms that we're able to see around the top of edge of the fells have been farmed by Teesdales at one point or another.
There was a very famous Teesdale who was a fell runner.
There was indeed.
Is he a relative of yours?
He's my uncle, Uncle Bill.
Uncle Bill was King of the Fells.
He was. Uncle Bill Teesdale, MVE, King of the Fells, the Colbeck Shepherd.
Gosh.
Quite a guy.
Because you're dressed as if you could run it. Do you run them?
Very slowly.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to laugh. I have to say, Ian can walk for miles and miles and miles and miles without seemingly ever getting tired. So I think he's got some of the physiology of Bill, who was able to fly through the hills.
Once upon a time, when I was about 30, Bill took me to one side and told me this story about another famous fell runner in the lakes, and his nephew had entered a fell race, and how embarrassing it had been. And I wasn't sure whether the story was true, or I was being instructed never, ever to enter a fell race. So the only fell race I've ever done, proper one, was in the Outer Hebrides, where he wouldn't find out.
Actually, the sport we do in the fells is orienteering.
Uh-huh.
We did it as a family belonging to the West Cumberland Orienteering Club and have run over all these hills looking for checkpoints. And it gives you the excuse to not run particularly fast, but it's also testing your navigation. I do less of it now, but Ian is an avid weekly orienteer.
Oh, really? Have you got a map with you now then, Ian?
I have, because it would be embarrassing to be asked that question on national radio and say no. So, yes, I've got a map. So, we're walking up this Bradway here, and then just keep going. If we get all the way up to these Little Scawfell, Great Scawfell, that'd be fantastic, and then we'll drop down over Meal Fell and either go up Great Cock Up...
Show me that? It is called Great Cock Up.
It's worth going up just for the name.
Oh, my gosh. I never knew that.
And then follow the obvious line back to the car.
So we are in the middle of the Cumbrian Mountains, it says.
Yep.
The highest peak here would be... obviously it's Scawfell Park.
The highest peak here is not.
Right.
But the highest peak in the region is... That pointy thing over there is Skiddaw, which is that usual backdrop to Keswick. Makes Keswick very scenic. But this is the... connoisseur's side of Skiddaw. Wainwright himself said, they know it not, who've only climbed Skiddaw from the south.
I know, I trust you, you won't get lost, but at least I know we've got a map in case you do. You mentioned Wainwright.
Yep.
He famously mapped and described, didn't he, the 214 fells, is it, the Wainwright fells?
He did.
How many of those have you scaled?
Well, I've done them all many times. I've done some of them probably hundreds of times. We finished a complete round back in about 1992, with the last hill being Longlands Fell that we're going up today.
Right now, you are embarking on a challenge to do them all again, yes?
Yeah.
And why? What's the motivation?
As a single round, it's quite a long story leading into it, but the upshot is that I have a terminal cancer diagnosis. And obviously that's quite a difficult thing to deal with, to come to terms with. I'd thrown myself into local cancer politics, helping cancer support groups, being on committees and things like that. And I realised that the support available, it's not sustainable. It relies on volunteers, it hasn't got any proper funding, etc, etc.
And is that specific to Cumbria or nationwide?
No, I'm sure it's completely nationwide. Yeah. So another thing that had happened... is I'd visited what's called the Maggie Centre down in Cheltenham, which is where my wife's parents live. And they were absolutely lovely. Drop-in centre, they've got psychologists, they've got people to advise you on health matters, financial matters, generally give you a hug and have a cup of tea. And having seen what was available down in Cheltenham, I wanted to raise awareness locally of what was possible. So I needed to do something that got a little bit of attention, a little bit of media coverage, and why not just do what I enjoy? Walking the Wainwrights. So I came up with a name, Terminal Illness, which is a little bit macabre, but we all cope with things in our different way. And Kath, who spent our married life saying, why do we have to go up hills all the time? Threw herself into this with an absolute passion.
That's a bit mean, but no, I do think I probably said, why do we have to go to the top all the time? Carry on.
So we're doing a complete round of the Wainwrights. Catherine's photo logging it on Instagram and Facebook. You can watch us do these things. The initial idea very quickly took over my life, and it became really, really important to me. And I realised that it's not just a journey through the hills. It's a journey through my own life, my own memories, and all of the things that have been important to me over my life. And they're locked up in these hills. So we're just coming off the bridleway here and turning up onto the grass path that leads up Longlands Fell.
We need to pause as we make this climb just to appreciate the view. And there's a farmer on his or her quad bike with a border collie's been running up behind. I think he's now jumped on the seat to be right up there. Little huddles of sheep sheltering close to hedgerows or indeed under the trees. And they've got also a half fallen down stone wall that gives them real protection from the wind, which is picking up. But Skiddaw standing proud, the clouds just sitting atop of it. And you can see a slither of what looks like snow just coming, or ice.
Somewhere, I think it might have been in that, there was a book about phrases that people use around the country or phrases that are being lost. But that little line of snow on Skidder, they would call a snow bone.
Oh.
Snow bones. And you often see, you know, ridges of snow. And it's lovely because they look like rib cages.
Ian, as we climb, can I ask you the history of your cancer?
I was diagnosed in around May 2021 through National Screening Programme. This is where you get a little kit through the post and they want a piece of your poo back. So it's really important, I stress to anybody who's listening, if you get that, do it. So on that, it's called a faecal occult blood test. And they diagnosed that there was something that needed investigation. So I went in and they snipped out some polyps, and one of them had a tiny piece of cancer in the middle of it. I was given the option of watch and wait or have surgery. So in August 2021, I had 6 inches of my large intestine removed, a procedure that looked to have been absolutely what they call potentially curative. I went back a year later, had a scan, and they found that it had somehow spread to my lungs, and I had lung secondaries, and that, unfortunately, is not curable.
How much is the walking that you're doing and also having this challenge, how much is it helping you mentally?
Cancer doesn't change the person that you are. I'm still the same person who happens to have cancer. This terminal illness project is absolutely central to my life, really, and it's part of how I'm coping with the cancer. I'm lucky that I'm still able to do it. So whilst I'm still able to do it, with the lack of breath in my body, I'll try and carry on walking up these hills. Okay, so we're getting a bit higher on Longlands now, and the sun's come out in part as well, so some of the hills got a little bit of sunlight on them. And in the far distance, so over in the northwest there, I can see Aspatria. It's about 10 miles away from here, and that's the town that I grew up in from when I was 6 until I left home to go to university at 18. And you can see Wickton, where I went to school. To our right is Caldbeck, which is really where my family are from. My mum was from there, my dad was from there. And High Pike to our right, which is that mountain there, which is where my Uncle Bill took me out as a little nipper to go for a walk. every Sunday we'd go and see my grandparents in a farmhouse in Colbeck. In the mid-1960s, a farmhouse in Colbeck was not the friendliest place for a five-year-old. So I'd sit there, not speaking, until I was spoken to. And then Bill would rescue me and say, "Oh, well, lad, should we go and get dogs and go up on the hill?"
You say, "Absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you."
So we'd go up on the low slopes there. Me, Bill, a rifle, and some terrified rabbits.
Look at that. That's almost below us. That's coming through the valley. And yeah, that's got to be a training plane. I mean, tiny, really fast. Yeah.
Often they come in pairs.
And jet black.
Trees.
The sun has just come up above the ridge that we're walking towards, but down below us in the valley, half a rainbow has appeared in such strong definition, and it looks to be falling right on that house, the white house over there. You probably know them, Ian, do you?
I do. It's the little village of Oldale. I know people who live in Oldale.
And it's not complete, Kath, is it? The rainbow isn't...
There's
no second half.
Oh, look over there.
Gosh, it's so far away. So what's that in the distance? Where's that falling? Into the Solway Firth? Near enough?
Or
no?
Actually, just actually on Colbeck Common there, but where it's coming down onto the mast. But yes, that is the Solway Plain and then the Solway Firth will be beyond there.
We were very lucky recently to be out in that spell of weather about a month ago when there were lots of strong inversions, where you get Brocken Spectres, which is your own personal little halo rainbow.
Wow.
We've got some marvellous photographs of that.
We'll do as best we can to capture photos of this walk, and you can see those on our Instagram account, which is at BBC Ramblings. Yeah. But on your Instagram account and Facebook, you've got all the photos, very much telling the story of your walking. And your Instagram is?
At Terminal Hillness.
With an H in the middle, very important.
Yes, exactly.
Hillness.
It's Hillness. We reached the summit where there was a cairn and it was so windy that it nearly blew us off our feet, and having dropped back down again, we've got protection now from the hills rising to the side and ahead of us and walking into the sun. There's a lone walker, do you see, or are they running up on that ridge? Just see that silhouette moving. There is something so invigorating though about the wind that hit us when we were up on top, but this walking here where there is literally one other person that we can see and no one else around, and it's an escape but it's a reconnection for you, Ian. How has your outlook on life changed knowing that the end point, as it were, is closer than it might have been?
That's quite a tricky one to answer. I sometimes liken it to swimming. When you're swimming, if you keep moving, keep doing things, keep going, but if you stop, you'll sink. And every so often, you have those moments when you sink. Mm. Quite often at 3 a.m. I suppose that I've changed my planning horizons to the next couple of weeks rather than anything longer. I have 3 monthly CT scans. We lost a lot this summer because I had an oncology meeting in July. And he said, that one's grown a lot. So he put me on radiotherapy through July. I was a really good patient. I rested for a couple of weeks after radiotherapy and then went back to my normal operations. We did a park run, 2 orienteering events and 2 hill walks in a week. And I completely exhausted myself and had to take another 2 weeks out. So, yeah, go with the flow, live in the moment.
Good one to not step into.
Yes, that's deep.
That sort of shows you how deep that bit could be as well.
So this is a massive puddle that is a good 2 feet deep, but with this boggy moss around it that you feel you could sink into. For the most part, the path has been fairly straightforward to navigate, but because of all that rain that came the last couple of days, when it is wet, the sections that are wet are really wet. Be careful. Right, big old stride over. When did the two of you first meet?
We first met when we were working for a little market research software company in Esher. We didn't really know each other. We both had other lives, and we then went our own ways. And then, in 2001, this little company had a party for all employees, past and present. So we went along, and we just really said, oh, how are you?
Actually, we got talking, and we realised we'd both seen all the Iranian films. We got quite a niche interest. I love indie films, and I'd lived in the States for 6 years, and I had just spent a lot of time watching foreign films, and Ian had seen all the same ones as me, and we suddenly thought, oh, we'd be quite good movie partners.
And 2 years later, we were married with a child.
And then we had kids, and then we stopped being able to go to the cinemas. But I would still love to go and see some indie films.
Well, you could pitch that on a day when it's not suitable for walking. A good cinema trip could
absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
Where's your nearest cinema?
The Keswick Alhambra is a really sweet one that has a film club on a Sunday. Yeah, it's very sweet. It was done up over during COVID, and it's all painted in original colours, and it's charming. It's got a balcony and beautiful toilets.
What more could you need?
Exactly. Yeah.
Are we going over this forward?
We're going
here?
Over the boggy patch.
When are we going to bend round?
Here.
Are we going,
here.
Oh, up that slope here. And then down.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Okay. Oh.
In the last hour or so, we have been through what felt like certainly two seasons. And we climbed up to the top of Meal Fell. So that was the third peak that we did. Then came down a very steep section. And the rain suddenly hit us, but the wind was so strong it blew on through. You had to concentrate so hard, or certainly I did, because I'm not very good at coming downhill, but I was thinking in about your uncle. He would have run down that in about 2.5 seconds.
Absolutely he would, and not made a fuss about it at all. They used to say, when they watched him coming down the hillside to the finish from a fell race, dressed in his white running top, he looked like a little white handkerchief fluttering down the hillside. It's such a nice, poetic way of putting it.
What a wonderful, endless adventure park to live in, that there are so many things to learn as well as see and do. And you do love, I mean, you've got a brain for science, actually, haven't you, Ian?
I have, yes. After school, I went and did physics at Oxford, and then I did a PhD in theoretical quantum physics at Liverpool University. And I got a job with the CGV, the old Central Electricity Generating Board.
And you've gone back to studying now, haven't you?
Well, I've never really lost the urge to study. And when the cancer came along, well, it started out as anger. I was so frustrated about communicating with oncologists and things, thinking, I could do better. Why don't I just do an oncology degree and then I'll be able to understand what's happening to me and what they're saying to me. The anger passed. I settled down. And then I returned to the idea that, but it would be interesting though, wouldn't it? And I found there are one or two cancer biology, oncology, distance learning courses knocking about. So I'm registered at Edinburgh University Medical School by the Institute of Cancer and Genetics, and I'm looking at cancer biology and precision oncology, which has the advantage of being modern genomics, which is high throughput genetic analysis, and the mathematical techniques that go with analysing that. So I don't know much molecular biology, but I can do the maths, and I'm loving it. To find that cancer is an intellectually fascinating disease, it's one way of coping.
Do you know what? My feet are muddy now, so I'm just going to go for it.
Can't go over it. Can't go round it.
Oh, no.
Okay. Even though the rushing water's there,
yeah.
The stones, I think, were firm.
Okay.
But then you need to step.
Okay.
But not that last bit.
Not on the brown ground.
Okay. Hang on. Yeah, it's pretty firm, this one, actually. Much better. Much better. Walking through the bracken now on a lovely grassy path towards our starting point, and we have done a big old loop round about 6.6 miles, I think we've done in total. It has been invigorating, uplifting, all the things I hope, Ian, that the reason that you're doing your terminal illness challenge. This is why, because at the during it and end, at the end of it, you just feel that that was a beautiful thing to experience.
I think it's just been a good smorgasbord of Lakeland conditions. We've had sunshine, rainbows, wind, rain. Been lovely.
Every walk that we've done has been so different and all beautiful in their own way. And, you know, what I would call some of the more boring hills, I've come back and just said, oh, I really enjoyed that. And it will just have been the light or the beauty of the place. Oh, and the company. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, otherwise we don't do a huge amount together other than live with each other. So it is a really good, it is a really good thing to do.
Yeah. So where's the, which is the next one and when?
Ian?
I don't plan that far ahead. What, the next nice day, which is looking about 2-3 weeks away now. I don't
Seriously,
know where,
I
where
am
we'll
quite
go.
Strict about the weather. I mean, if it's like this, look at it. Just the light on the dead bracken that makes it golden and puffy clouds. It makes it a joy to do.
Good luck with the challenge.
Thank you very much.
And indeed, the feeling behind it, the sentiment behind it of raising awareness that particularly in this part of the country, there are not enough places where you can go and get the support that you need if you have a cancer diagnosis.
Thanks for coming along and thanks for showing that support as well.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I've loved it. My knees have held up just about.
Good. You didn't want to break.
No, don't break me.
Ramblings with Claire Balding is produced in Bristol by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios audio production for Radio 4. In a few moments, we'll meet a farmer who single-handedly runs a herd of Wagyu beef cattle in Norfolk. First, let's hear about a major new series starting on Monday.
The history of the Middle East is a complicated and contested one that often leads us to ask, how did we get here? I'm Johnny Diamond, and in this new series, with the help of some expert guests, I'm going to go back to biblical times and work through to the present day in an attempt to answer that question. We'll talk about some of the key people and events that have shaped the region over the centuries. That's How Did We Get Here? Israel and the Palestinians, with me, Johnny Diamond, on Monday evenings at 8 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now, Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. In this week's programme, we'll hear from the brave new world of the first-time farmer.
We watch a lot of YouTube videos. The fences are still standing, so I think we've done a reasonably good job.
I think it looks really good. our neighbour thought that we were mad. It's like, why are you not getting a contractor in to do this?
And discover why this is no longer music to the ears of the RSPCA.
We know they're a negative experience for animals. And compared to, for example, a solid fence, there's no visual cue for the cattle using these collars that shock is about to come.
More on all that later. Let's start, though, with a farmer who has gone back to her farming family roots after working variously as a PE teacher and a journalist. Sarah Juggins now single-handedly runs a herd of Wagyu beef. Anna Hill caught up with her delivering hay to the cows.
Just winding that wire back in again. And we're going to unwrap it.
Yeah. This year was quite difficult. I mean, this winter fodder, the drought and not that much grass growing.
Yeah, it was a real problem. I mean, I was very lucky to secure quite a number of bales of this good quality hay, but not enough, actually. So what we've got over here, if you...
Yeah, let's have a look.
This is a silage that's been made out of wild bird mix. And it was something we'd never done before. Now, it's not the best, but they get that as well as the hay, and they seem really happy with it, which is pleasing because I've got 80 bales of it, so, you know, I'm pleased they're happy with it. Another farmer has been growing me pea silage, so we use vining peas and make silage from that, which is a really, really lovely mix for the cattle as well.
How many animals have you got at the moment?
I have got 36 at the moment.
That's a lot to look after.
It's a lot to look
after. And it's just you.
It's just me, yeah. If I have a day, like a TB testing, for example, friends and neighbours will come and help with that sort of thing. I've got a farmer down the road who helps me if I need to move things, you know, on a big scale. People help, you know, the community helps, and I think that's a really, really lovely thing. And I pay them back with boxes of beef every so often and things like that.
Coming from Japan, these animals, what are they used to?
I mean, it's very, very different. I guess this is the point of difference that I'm quite proud of. So Wagyu that comes from Japan, people will be very, very familiar with the pictures of almost completely white meat, you know, because it's so run through with marbled fat. I don't think that's particularly palatable for the majority of the British diet. And the reason it's like that is because these animals are kept in conditions that... I'm not judging this. These are conditions that works for the Japanese Wagyu market. They're kept in buildings. They are fed an extremely scientifically and rigorously tested diet that will allow the marbling to develop to its very, very best potential. Key to all of that is the genetics of the animal, so making sure you've got the right genetics to produce the high marbling. And then they're kept in those buildings. So they don't get an awful lot of exercise, and I'm a former PE teacher, and I think that everybody should do exercise. So my cattle, they have the right genetics, they have access to great quality food, but they also move a lot. And this means that they've got muscle and they've got fat. So when you see the meat, yes, there'll be marbling, but it won't be that type white Japanese fat that we've got.
You can hear more from Sarah and Anna tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on BBC Radio 4 in On Your Farm, or afterwards on BBC Sounds. Well, Sarah went back to her farming roots, but all this week we've been talking about new entrants to the industry, those who want to farm but don't have land. The price of buying or renting a farm can make it hard if you're not from a farming family. We spoke to a variety of people who have made it work despite the many challenges. And Nancy Nicholson has been to meet a young couple who realised their dream by leaving behind their city lives in York and moving hundreds of miles to the Western Isles.
Come on, sheep!
Come on, sheep!
So this is a croft at 13 and 14 Garranin. It's about 5 hectares in size. We got the croft back in October, so we've just been starting to move animals onto it, and we're renovating the croft house as well.
Currently have ducks, chickens and sheep.
I'm with Luke and Helena Crossland-Thompson, and it's a crisp, very cold winter's day. A great day to see the croft, gorgeous. Actually. So we're standing, looking right on to the full length of the croft, and it goes a long way up into the hill there, but it's absolutely covered in rushes and ruins.
Yes.
So you have your work cut out, guys.
We do, yeah. So the croft itself, we're quite lucky in that it has been used, so it's not completely overgrown, but there are a lot of rushes, and we have some very nice old dry stone pens and other structures, but they are in need of a bit of TLC, and the ditches need some work as well.
You are brand new crofters. Why did you come so far?
We've been planning a move like this for several years, so
we've looked at land in Yorkshire, Wales. We basically needed something the right size and the right price point.
The price was the biggest one, and also just finding like readily advertised small acreages was really difficult.
And you have a foot on that farming ladder now.
Yeah.
Is it what you dreamed of? You're screwing up your faces.
I mean, there's been like ups and downs, definitely. If you're doing anything with animals, there's always going to be something that goes wrong, and we've had plenty of that. But there's also been plenty of stuff that, having tried for the first time, we've managed to do successfully.
And you're both still working. Luke, you have a job here, and Helena, you work mainly online.
I am, and I work from home. I was doing that in York, so I was very lucky that I had a job that I could just move house, and it hasn't been a problem.
And you're learning new skills.
Yes.
Fencing.
Yeah.
That is very impressive.
We watched a lot of YouTube videos. The fences are still standing, so I think we've done a reasonably good job.
I think it looks really good. Our neighbour thought that we were mad. It's like, why are you not getting a contractor in to do this? But I think with a lot of things in crofting and farming, you just have to like give it a go.
Yeah.
So would you recommend making the move?
I've no regrets doing it, certainly. It's been a great experience. Local crofters have been really, really helpful and really welcoming.
They're just happy that young people are getting involved and are interested. And as long as you're open to listening to them and their experiences, then they're happy to help you.
Nancy Nicholson reporting there. Much more on new entrants. Just search for Farming Today on BBC Sounds. MPs on the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Select Committee say the government must seek carve-outs or exemptions on alignment when negotiating with the EU to avoid unnecessary burdens and undercutting of farmers. In May last year, many farmers and food producers were cheered by the news that a common SPS, that's a sanitary and phytosanitary agreement, was on the cards. It would mean that the vast majority of movements of animals, animal products, plants and plant products between Great Britain and the EU could be undertaken taken without certificates or controls. Since the UK formally left the EU in January 2021, the UK became what's called a third country trader, with food exports subject to inspections and bureaucracy that are thought to have cost hundreds of millions of pounds. Well, this new trade agreement is now expected to come into place by 2027, but there are concerns that the deal will bring the need for realignment of rules, because since Brexit, the UK has diverged on things like animal welfare, gene editing and pesticide regulation. Alistair Carmichael is the Liberal Democrat chair of the EFRA committee.
Essentially, this is about easier access to markets within the European Union. It would strengthen our competitiveness, it would strengthen our food security, and it would give us that extra element of resilience in supply chains. But in the background, the law of unintended consequences is never far away.
Well, let's look at a couple of examples. Animal welfare, for instance. The committee has a recommendation saying we need exemptions from aligning with the EU on things like animal welfare so that we don't have to change our rules every time the EU changes their rules. But that might be difficult, mightn't it?
It could indeed be difficult. So the implementation period would be important. But, you know, these exemptions are possible. The Swiss have an exemption in the agreement that they have with the European Union. But as things stand, I can't even tell you with certainty whether or not on-farm animal welfare is part of what is being negotiated or not. So the danger is we don't get sufficient input before an agreement is signed, and then afterwards, the way the scrutiny of treaties and agreements of this sort works within the House of Commons, we may not have sufficient parliamentary scrutiny either.
Your report talks about carve-outs. What sorts of things do you mean there?
The government needs to be talking to the people who are experts here. So that is the people who are growing the crops, raising the cattle, the people who are doing some of the really interesting and quite exciting work around precision breeding and gene editing, which could be under threat if you don't have a carve-out for that. That's something which we have in England, and not in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. We've got some really progressive, groundbreaking work going ahead there. It's a very well-regulated sector. And I know also, actually, that the EU Commission are quite keen that they should be able to bring member states in the European Union closer to where England is at the moment. There are areas like this where the Union will be wanting to bring themselves closer to us.
That's interesting, isn't it? For instance, on pesticides, there are different rules, aren't there now, between the EU and the UK on pesticides. So that certainly needs to be on the table, doesn't it?
It absolutely has to be on the table, because there are a lot of products that are consented for use in the UK but not in the European Union, and vice versa.
We have been away from the table for a long time, haven't we? So how much bargaining power has the UK really got?
Look, this is a deal that can be made and is in the interests of both sides. But I was struck taking the committee out to Brussels by just how easily we have forgotten how to do politics and how to do business in Brussels. So there is going to have to be a job of work in re-educating our civil servants, our ministers, our politicians, our farmers, our fishermen, and all the other interest groups who have kind of ignored what was happening there, and re-educate them about how to do business. There are lots of opportunities here, but nobody should go away thinking that this is going to be an easy process, because it will not.
Alistair Carmichael, the chair of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee, talking there to Anna. Now, a new report published by the Resolution Foundation says the government's goal of net zero across the UK could force less profitable farms into debt and lead to 3,500 farms losing money. It says progress to decarbonise farming has been slow and there is no silver bullet, which will do, as it puts it, the heavy lifting for the sector to reduce its impact on climate change. The report points out that farmers risk sharp income falls on already fragile businesses. Well, Anna spoke to Zachary Leather, economist at the Resolution Foundation, who co-authored this report.
the costs of meeting net zero in farming are actually pretty small. It's only around 2 to 3% of the cost of running a farm day to day. The problem is that farming is in a really, really precarious financial situation for lots of factors that are nothing to do with net zero. You know, and that's why we find that farming incomes are really low, with, you know, the average farm in 2024 making just £6 an hour. That's like barely half the minimum wage. So what we want to think about is not necessarily be scared about the cost, but be thinking really carefully about how to allocate them. If consumers, instead of farmers and, like, you know, the rest of the supply chain, including supermarkets, food distributors, if they were taking on the cost of this net zero, you'd barely notice it. The inflation that you'd see in food prices, for example, would be comfortably less than 1% over 25 years, which is not very big when you're thinking about this very, very long transition. Farmers, on the other hand, if they were forced to bear these costs, as we fear that they would, then those income falls would be big. You know, net zero cost being put on farmers would cut incomes by a fifth. So it's less about the cost being big and more about who bears them.
At the moment, farmers have been given taxpayers' money to implement environmental schemes which do go towards the net zero target. Should there be more money for that to help farmers bear the cost of decarbonising?
It is the taxpayer, it is the household that eventually pays for that. And so it's not a way of kind of avoiding consumers taking any costs of this. What we're seeing with the subsidies, like the sustainable farming incentive, a lot of the time, in order to, if you want to use subsidy to both persuade farmers to do things as well as compensate them, you end up both paying quite a lot. So if we want to do this in a cost-efficient way that gets costs down for the taxpayer, as well as getting costs down for the farmer and getting costs down for the consumer, then we need to be thinking more about how to, you know, use market mechanisms, which is why we recommend regulations that try and put the burden on supermarkets.
But if the cost is passed on to the consumer in the shops, wouldn't that just make British produce more expensive and less able to compete with imports?
Yeah, it's vital that any solution also deals with the fact that, you know, farmers are, you know, exposed to competition externally. And that's one of the reasons why we suggest going with a carbon emissions standard, which would apply also to, you know, incoming imports as well, to ensure that they aren't simply undercut.
Your report recognises that some land use definitely has to change. Using land for solar energy, for instance, how do you suggest those land use pressures are resolved?
Land use change is often misunderstood. Solar is likely to be an extremely small part of the land that changes use. Largely, this is for forestry, restoring peatlands. The land that changes use is also going to become part of our natural environment. It's about a shifting of the role of the farmer, in some cases, from being one of growing foods to one of being a custodian of the land. Those subsidies we were talking about earlier should be used to funding this land use change instead.
Zachary Leather from the Resolution Foundation. Electronic collars are to be banned for dairy cows under new rules for the RSPCA's Assured scheme. The collars are used instead of fencing and make a noise and then deliver an electric shock to the cow if she goes outside a prescribed area. It's part of wider changes to the RSPCA assurance scheme. It's also introducing a requirement for more access to pasture, a minimum of 120 days a year, and changes to the rules around the transport of pregnant cows. The rules will change in April. Sam Sandberg farms near Chipping Norton in Oxfordshire and uses electronic collars on her cattle.
If they approach the boundary, they can hear a tune that they associate with "don't go any further". This is enabling me to graze lots of areas that haven't been fenced, or one can't afford to fence, or you simply don't want to fence. Not only can you strip graze within a field, but you can graze these sort of little pockets that just wouldn't be worth you grazing otherwise. It wouldn't be worth you setting up a fence for.
Farmer Sam Sandberg. I asked Dr. Holly Gower, Senior Scientific and Policy Officer for the RSPCA, why they're bringing this ban in.
It's something that we have some concerns about. So, for example, the use of electric shock collars has some ethical problems associated with it. We know they're a negative experience for animals. And compared to, for example, a solid fence, there's no visual cue for the cattle using these collars that shock is about to come. They do have some audio cues associated with them, but not that sort of visual evidence that there would be for a solid fence line. One of the areas that we'd like to see explored is sort of alternatives to this that are less negative for cattle or ideally positive. We don't know what that looks like. Obviously, that would be an area for research, but we'd love to see that explored to move away from that negative stimulus of the electric shock. There's also an element with the electric shocks that if cattle pass over a boundary, so for example, if they were being chased by a dog, and they exit that edge of where the virtual fencing says they can go, for some systems, they will then receive further shocks beyond that boundary. So you can imagine for an animal being chased by a dog, for example, they might receive for some systems up to 3 electric shocks in a row as they aim to escape. And it's a multiple shock that they would be receiving.
Although lots of people who use these say that the cattle go to the edge, they get an electric shock and they never, ever do it again. So it's a very limited shock.
Yeah, the research out there, it does show some mixed effects, as you say. So there are cattle that are faster learners on this, and there are some that take that bit of time to sort of work out that association with the audio cue and the electric shock. And of course, for all cattle, they are going to have to go through that training period of learning that that noise means that something unpleasant is about to happen. Predominantly, the standard that we've changed refers to commercial systems, so where people are commercially farming dairy cattle, unlike some of the systems that we might see this sort of technology employed in, for example, conservation grazing. So for our commercial dairy cattle, where they're perhaps being in a rotational grazing system in smaller areas, you might have sort of 3 or 4 of those boundaries with the virtual fencing rather than anything solid. So there's sort of multiple boundaries for them to learn in potentially quite a small area, which is obviously a lot more problematic than perhaps a large diffuse area where cattle are roaming acres and acres in a conservation setting. So although we are against virtual fencing in a commercial setting, we are taking that balanced view of there are settings where we can see the value of it more than others. And for us, it always has to be, is the balance of welfare positive or is it negative? And for commercial settings, we feel that the factors that I've just discussed make this a more negative experience than a positive one for cattle.
Isn't that a bit hypocritical? Because if cattle are conservation grazing and they get a shock, the animal welfare effect is exactly the same as if they're in a commercial setting.
Yeah, of course, a shock is a shock, you're quite right. But it's sort of that overall picture that we're trying to look at. So in a conservation setting, for example, where this system may be being used to prevent cattle accessing something that would be much more severely negative to them, you know, a crumbling cliff edge or a highly marshy, boggy area where they're likely to get stuck or entangled in something, for example. So it's that balance of harms versus positives. Obviously, the electric shock element is still something for all settings we'd like to see moved away from. But if you look at the whole experience of that individual animal wearing the collar in that setting, there are some farmed or conservation settings where there are more likely to be more positives, i.e. an animal is being kept from much more significant harm in some more dangerous areas of grazing.
Dr. Holly Gower from the RSPCA. Well, that prompted quite a few people to get in touch. We are farming.today@bbc.co.uk. Christina Auckland said, I completely understand and respect the welfare concerns being raised. At the same time, this is a nuanced area, she says, and presenting only one side risks oversimplifying the issue and clouding the public's judgment on something that, when used carefully and responsibly, has the potential to be used for real good in certain contexts. Keith Valentine also emailed us. He helps manage conservation grazing on the Old Lodge Nature Reserve in Sussex using these collars. He said, the RSPCA's objection to them is naive and illogical. Of course the mild shock it delivers has a negative effect. It wouldn't work if it didn't. The same, he says, applies to barbed wire. Well, Tristram Stewart is an author and environmental campaigner who owns the cattle, Belted Galloways, which graze that reserve.
Their main job is what's called conservation grazing of the Heathland Nature Reserve at Old Lodge in the Ashdown Forest. We can't go fencing the entire valley, let alone the whole of the Ashdown Forest, which is thousands of hectares of heathland, which is common land and open to all. The best way of bringing these large herbivores back into the landscape is to use no fence collars, which means we don't have to pay for fences, we don't have to use miles and miles of steel. You know, traditional fences also get in the way of everything else. All the other wildlife that wants to move around the landscape would be stopped by a fence. Whereas a no-fence collar allows me to put a barrier in place for my cows and my cows only.
What about the welfare impact, though, on your Belties?
One of the things that frustrates me a little bit when I hear about the negative impacts of no-fence collars is a lack of the perspective of the big picture. My cattle live richer, more satisfying, abundant lives than any cattle in the kingdom. They have miles to walk over. When I compare their lives to the vast majority of cattle that live in monotonous, square, green plots we call fields, my cattle have the life that they're evolved to live.
And yet, to achieve all that, you do have to give them electric shocks to keep them where you want them to be.
A normal electric fence does exactly that. A cow can push down an electric fence easily, and it learns not to walk through that fence because when it touches it a few times, it's like, ooh, there's a shock. The no-fence collars work by, instead of a visual cue, it's an audio cue. So they hear 3 metres short of the boundary. If they hear that tone and then they get a shock, they very quickly learn that that tone means turn back and go away. So when you put collars onto a cow for the first time, for a couple of weeks, they walk into the boundary and they get a shock which is less voltage than a normal electric fence. And yeah, they don't like it. That's why they turn back. The big picture is that they benefit vastly more as a result of this innovation than they suffer.
And to be clear, the RSPCA itself is making a distinction between cattle in the system that you've just described and cattle in dairy herds. And in dairy herds, they're saying, in RSPCA assured herds, then these collars will no longer be allowed. What do you make of that?
So I'm glad, and you're right, that the RSPCA specifically say that in conservation grazing contexts, it's fine to use these collars. What I wish they would do when they communicate about this is address the positives that these collars bring, both in terms of conservation, but also in terms of welfare. And that's what I think is lacking. When you only talk about the negatives, it gives the wrong impression. The overall impact on the welfare of the cattle of these collars is vast improvement of lifestyle and ability to roam freely. I'm not against them being in favour of better regulation around no-fence collars. I do wish they would communicate that big picture of the potential overriding welfare benefits of these collars.
Tristram Stewart. Well, that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Rebecca Rooney. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Plenty to look forward to this morning. Today is in a few minutes here on Radio 4. Then Professor Patricia Wiltshire will explain the role of a forensic botanist on Saturday Live at 9. The actor Mackenzie Crook will also be on, unveiling the secrets behind his latest TV drama. And Alexander Armstrong will be with us as well. That's from 9 o'clock. But now it's time for the weather forecast. And Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, everybody. This may come as no surprise at all, but the weather remains really quite cloudy and, for some of us, really quite wet this morning as well. We've also got some patches of mist and fog out there first thing, so do take care if you are setting off early this morning. But for Wales and southwest England, well, it's rain that's been moving its way north and eastward. It's now just clearing parts of southwest England into the West Country, really, into South Wales as well, continuing to move north and eastward. It'll turn more fragmented and then there'll be some showers following behind. So it means into the afternoon we will see quite a lot of showers, a few drier spells, maybe an opportunity to just to get outside for a short while before the showers come through, maybe a few bright spells as well. Temperatures of 7 to 11 degrees. Now, for southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, this is where we've got the most extensive mist and fog this morning. That's going to clear away. While it's dry for many to start, we've already got the rain moving into southeast England, parts of the southwest Midlands as well. That rain continuing to move north and east, was quite heavy for a time this morning, but gradually it's going to ease off. So this afternoon, more showery. So there'll be some drier spells into the afternoon. Maximum temperatures getting to about 9 to 12 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, well, again, mist and fog patches this morning. Rain affecting the far north around the Lake District was Northumberland. That rain is going to continue, turning quite drizzly into the afternoon. Further south across northern England, while a dry start, we will see rain moving its way into showers this afternoon and temperatures of 6 to 10 degrees. For Northern Ireland, overcast and pretty damp this morning, rain and drizzle, turning a little bit drier into the afternoon, highs of 8 or 9 degrees. And for Scotland, the dull weather continues, overcast skies, rain and drizzle for much of Scotland this morning. Still a bit wintry over the Grampians as well. It might become a little bit drier this afternoon, especially in western Scotland, but otherwise staying quite damp and drizzly. Temperatures of 4 to 6 Celsius.
Blades slicing through ice at an electrifying pace. Skis flying further than ever before. Curling stones sliding with breathtaking precision. Making history, breaking records, and taking home gold. Trails will blaze. The Winter Olympics. Watch live on BBC iPlayer.
This is BBC Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker.
Hello, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 7th of February. This is Today with Simon Jack and Amol Rajan.
The headlines this morning, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said he regrets appointing Lord Mandelson to his government as he pledges to confront the abuse of political power. We'll be speaking to Gordon Brown live at 10 past 8. Donald Trump says he hadn't seen a video portraying Barack and Michelle Obama as apes, which was posted on his Truth Social account. And the government is offering interest-free loans to thousands of retired civil servants who haven't received their pensions since Capita started running the scheme.
Also in today's programme, we'll be speaking to the government's new cost-of-living champion, supermarket boss-turned-Labour peer Richard Walker, for his first broadcast interview since being appointed. We'll be reporting from Japan as voters go to the polls in a snap election. As inflation bites and the country struggles with rising prices, will the political gamble pay off for Japan's first female prime minister?
Takaichi has historically high approval rating. There is sort of an atmosphere of positivity about her being the first female prime minister in Japanese history, being successful at diplomacy.
And
she's a grand old lady. She's beautiful. She fills me with such joy. She stood there for 170 years, the matriarch of the whole area. She's all green and full of lovely leaves. She's home to quite a few little birds and all that as well.
Why residents of One Street in Glasgow could see their 170-year-old ash tree win the niche, but nonetheless coveted, European Tree of the Year award.
Good morning from Mike Williams with your Saturday Sport. After two opening ceremonies last night, day one of the multi-venue Winter Olympics in Milan Cortina is underway. It's also the start of the T20 Cricket World Cup. The first match is underway right now and we will be live in Sri Lanka.
The BBC News is read this morning by Tom Sanders.
The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he greatly regrets bringing Lord Mandelson back into government in 2008. Writing in The Guardian, Mr. Brown says there were no reports at the time of Lord Mandelson having a friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Police are currently looking into claims that Lord Mandelson sent market-sensitive government information to Epstein. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
In his article, Gordon Brown said he wanted to express his revulsion at what has been uncovered about Jeffrey Epstein and his impact on our politics. Mr. Brown writes that he gave Peter Mandelson a job in government in 2008 because he thought his unquestioned knowledge of Europe and beyond could help us as we dealt with the global financial crisis. I now know that I was wrong, he writes. I greatly regret this appointment. Emails released by the US government last week appear to suggest Lord Mandelson, who was business secretary, was sharing sensitive government information with Epstein while Mr. Brown was in number 10. Met police officers investigating claims of misconduct in public office offences carried out searches at Lord Mandelson's London home yesterday and a country house he uses in Wiltshire. The former Labour peer, who resigned from both the party and the House of Lords this week, has previously denied any wrongdoing. It's understood he believes he has not acted in any way criminally.
Documents from the release by the US Department of Justice appear to show Lord Mandelson recommended a holiday home in southern Italy in which Jeffrey Epstein could host what he described as guests. A spokesperson for Peter Mandelson said he did not discover the truth about Epstein until after his death. Harriet Agerholm reports.
In an email to Epstein dated August 2010, Peter Mandelson wrote that he'd found the convicted sex offender a great place to stay on the Amalfi Coast. It offered, in his words, privacy, with accompanying rooms for your guests. Quote marks are used around the word guests in the email, although it's unclear which guests are being referred to, and we haven't determined if Epstein went on to stay in the accommodation. The email address the message was sent from has been redacted, but a joint BBC investigation with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism has identified Lord Mandelson. His lawyers said he had no recollection of sending the email. A spokesperson said Lord Mandelson didn't discover the truth about Epstein until after his death, and he was profoundly sorry that powerless and vulnerable women and girls were not given the protection they deserved.
The Liberal Democrats have suspended Lord Renard from the party and opened a new investigation into allegations of harassment made against him more than 10 years ago. In a statement, Lord Renard said the allegations were investigated at the time by police, who took no further action, and an independent lawyer said there was insufficient evidence for disciplinary action against him. But the party says it's received legal advice that the investigation in 2013 was flawed in several respects. President Trump has said he did not see the section of a video posted on his social media account that depicted Barack and Michelle Obama as apes. After initially defending it, the White House removed it, saying a staff member had posted it by mistake. Here's our North America correspondent, Simi Jalalshow.
Speaking to reporters on Air Force One, President Trump said he only watched the first part of the video that rehashed unproven claims of voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, so he didn't know about the offensive clip it included nearer the end. That part of the video depicted several high-profile Democrats as animals and received widespread condemnation, including from members of his own party, with the only black Republican senator, Tim Scott, describing it as the most racist thing he'd seen out of this White House. The president's spokesperson initially dismissed the backlash as fake outrage, but the video was later taken down. When asked whether he renounced portraying the Obamas as apes, Mr. Trump said, of course, but declined to apologize.
No, I didn't make a mistake. I mean, I look at a lot of thousands of things. I looked at the beginning of it, it was fine.
This is not the first time President Trump has been accused of targeting Barack Obama using racist tropes. He peddled the false birther conspiracy theory that President Obama was not born in the U.S., The Obamas are yet to comment on the video.
Ukraine says Russia has launched what it's called a massive attack on its energy infrastructure. The state grid operator said there were power cuts in most regions. Earlier this week, a Russian attack left hundreds of thousands of people without heating. A 15-year-old boy has been charged with inflicting grievous bodily harm on a teacher at a school in Pembrokeshire. Officers were called to Milford Haven Comprehensive on Thursday afternoon. The boy will also face a charge of possession of a bladed article when he appears at Swansea Magistrates Court later today. The Cabinet Office has told Radio 4's Moneybox it has started handing out emergency interest-free loans to some of the thousands of recently retired civil servants who have not received their pensions. The Public and Commercial Services, or PCS Union, which represents many civil servants, has described the situation as catastrophic and is calling for urgent action from the government and says the firm running the pension scheme Capita must put things right. Dan Whitworth reports.
With 1.7 million members, the Civil Service Pension Scheme is one of the largest in the UK. But since Capita took over running it in early December, the PCS union says a backlog of cases has grown sharply from 86,000 to around 120,000. Crucially, it says more than 8,000 of those involve recently retired people who haven't been paid what they're owed, leaving some, in the words of the union, destitute, unable to pay mortgages, rent and day-to-day household bills. Capita and the Cabinet Office, which is ultimately responsible, said they're both deeply sorry, admit the current situation is unacceptable, and have drafted in extra staff to put things right as soon as possible.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average in New York has closed above 50,000 points for the first time. The Dow's biggest boost came from the construction and mining manufacturer Caterpillar, whose share price rose by more than 7% yesterday. Analysts believe there's been a broadening of investments in areas other than computer technology and artificial intelligence. The Winter Olympics have officially begun in Italy, with the lighting of the cauldrons in Milan and Cortina taking place last night. A colourful, tightly choreographed opening ceremony was split across four locations, with live celebrations also in Livigno and Predazzo. The main event in the San Siro Stadium in Milan featured the Italian tenor singer Andrea Bocelli. Our correspondent Joe Curry was there.
The 25th Winter Olympics opened with a fitting celebration of sport and the arts. Mariah Carey stole the show with her rendition of the Italian classic Volare. Team GB's athletes, watched by Princess Anne, entered the San Siro wearing hats and scarves designed by the Olympic diver and keen knitter Tom Daly, and were led into the stadium by the ice skater Lila Fear. Team USA were clapped in by Vice President JD Vance, cheered by some of the crowd.
I think you've got a mixed reception, Hazel. Don't want to be contentious.
Now that the Games have officially opened, the first Olympic medals will be won this weekend. Later today, Team GB's curlers will look to maintain their unbeaten run in the mixed doubles, whilst Kirsty Muir goes in qualifying for the women's freeski slopestyle.
Joe Curry reporting.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom. It's 9 minutes past seven. Let's take you through some of the papers, and I'll focus on the story which is really dominating all the front pages. It's pictures of the police raid on Peter Mandelson's homes, not one but two. Daily Telegraph. Police raid on Mandelson's homes. They used warrants to enter his properties in London and Wiltshire after leak of government papers to Epstein. The same story and pictures on the front of the Daily Mail. Police knock on door of Mandelson's £12 million London home and remove boxes of evidence. Same stories on the front of the Sun. Police rummage through Mandy's drawers. The front of the Times is Rayner, I warned Starmer not to appoint Mandelson. And there's a sort of briefing war, it seems to be underway between allies of Angela Rayner on the one hand and allies of Wes Streeting on the other, the two of those being potential successors to Peter Mandelson. And meanwhile, in The Guardian, Gordon Brown has a column which we led the bulletins with, in which he says that we need to clean up public life, and he deeply regrets the appointment of Peter Mandelson to a senior job in government in 2008. Gordon Brown will be live on this programme at 10 past 8.
And the sound of knives being sharpened for Keir Starmer actually makes the front page of the FT Weekend, which says that a threat to Starmer's leadership would be bad for the market, invoke the risk of a Liz Truss style surge in interest rates if it was pushed aside. They've got a couple of quotes. Andy Higginson, chair of retailer JD Sports, said the big fear was that the party would move to the left. They say if the UK saw a leadership that decides to go down fiscal expansion, borrowing more money, then the gilt market, government bond market, would likely throw a wobbly. It's a classic case of the devil you know. And also there's plenty of coverage, preview coverage of the Winter Olympics, with an interesting picture of Snoop Dogg, the rap star, on the curling rink. Apparently he is the honorary coach for the US curling team, and he was had pictures taken with a couple of the British competitors.
We'll come back to many of those issues, by the way, in our Saturday panel at 10 to 9. For now, let's focus on the challenges for Keir Starmer, as well as the pursuit of justice for survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse, with Billy Kemba, our political correspondent. I should just say we're going to look at how Keir Starmer should do justice by those survivors and also regain control of the Parliamentary Labour Party, because Baroness Harriet Harman had this advice for Sir Keir Starmer on her podcast, which is called Electoral Dysfunction.
Firstly, he's got to stop blaming Mandelson and saying he lied to me, because actually he should never have been considering him in the first place. And to say he lied to me makes it look weak and naive and gullible. It's just completely the wrong thing. He should be reflecting on why he made that appointment, not angry at the evilness of Peter Mandelson.
Well, Billy Kemba is our political correspondent. Billy, morning. At 10 past 8, when we talk to Gordon Brown, we'll be looking at his ideas for reforms in public life and getting justice for the survivors of Jeffrey Epstein. But in terms of the Labour Party dynamics here, the tenor of the reporting in all the papers this morning really is that Keir Starmer's time is up.
I think that reflects the mood among many MPs, that it's not now a question of if he's going to go, it's just a question of when, and speculation that may yet take some time, perhaps in May after the local elections. I think that there is a widespread view that this is now terminal, that this raises questions that go beyond the judgment of his staff or senior officials, the sort of questions that might be answered by sacking his chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, for example, and go to questions about his own judgment. And certainly the view of many MPs is that is now terminal, that it is irredeemable for him to recover his authority over the Labour Party.
And the issue is that basically the argument, the line that Keir Starmer has held, which is that he was lied to, is deemed sort of intellectually and morally insufficient by lots of people. We heard what Harriet Harman was saying there, which is that it's not strong enough, doesn't really wash politically, but also that, A, there was enough known in the public domain about Jeffrey Epstein and Peter Manson's relationship, and B, even if Keir Starmer didn't look at all the stuff that was in the public domain, he should have asked better questions, and that vetting process of Peter Manson before he was made ambassador to Washington should have been better.
Yes, exactly that. And there was, I think, a real tipping point on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions when the Prime Minister was asked three times by Kemi Badenoch whether vetting material had flagged that there was a sort of ongoing post-conviction relationship between Epstein and Mandelson. And on the third time of asking, the Prime Minister said yes, that he admitted that there was. Now, that was known, really, if you look at what was in the public domain at the time of the appointment. But hearing it from his mouth in the heart of the House of Commons, I think, has really been a turning point in the minds of many Labour MPs.
And to be clear, Billy, one of the things that was known in the public domain at that time was that in 2009, while Jeffrey Epstein was in prison for soliciting sex from a minor, at that time Peter Manson stayed in his Manhattan townhouse.
Exactly. So it was known that there was a relationship. The friendship continued after that conviction in 2008 for soliciting underage sex. Obviously, we've learnt much more in the last week about the depth of that relationship. And the Prime Minister's position is that Lord Mandelson lied about that, told him that he had barely known Epstein. And we've obviously seen a great tranche of emails in the last week which show them regularly corresponding and exchanging potentially market-sensitive information in Mandelson's case while he was in government. But certainly on that basic fact of whether they were still in touch, whether they still had a relationship after that 2008 conviction, that was already known when he decided to send him to Washington.
Billy Kemba, thank you very much indeed.
16 minutes past seven, very nearly. Time to talk rubbish, in particular 25,000 tonnes of it in an illegal waste dump in Wigan, which represents a grave environmental hazard, according to the Lords Environment Committee. There's an ongoing debate about who has responsibility to clear it up and who should bear the cost. But while that goes on, residents have to live with it. Nisha Rosen is a resident who lives, I understand, Nisha, 15 metres away from the dump. I mean, what is that like? Can you describe it to us?
It's not even hell, to be honest. We've got rats, we've got flies, the smells are diabolical. It's absolutely disgusting. It's life-destroying.
And have you, I mean, who have you spoken to about getting it cleared up? What have the council said to you?
So initially we reported in October 24, November 24, and we spoke to the Environment Agency, the council and the police, and basically they all just started passing the buck to each other, and the Environment Agency, you couldn't actually get through to an actual person, it was just call handlers. So we were basically ignored, and now the council have stepped up a little bit. They're trying to help with the pest control because they've agreed, you know, that's the right thing to do. However, the Environment Agency just keeps saying it's a criminal investigation. That's all we get. As residents, we've had this for over a year now. It's a criminal investigation.
I was going to say, how long has this been going on? And I understand you've got a young son as well. And what is the impact on your life?
So it's been going on since October 24. So the main problem we have is the smells. So we've got two children, both autistic, but one of them's got sensory processing disorder, which means heightened sense of smell. So he refuses to live at home. He can't cope. It makes him physically sick when the smells are, you know, high. He won't eat. He won't drink. So it's, in effect, it's causing a bit of like an eating disorder when he's at home. So in order to make sure his needs are met, he actually lives with his grandparents most of the time.
So he's had to effectively move out. And are people still dumping stuff? Is it still growing? What's the status of it?
So the dumping actually stopped in February 25 because they ran out of space, but a closure order wasn't actually put until August, which was a bit pointless. Well, July, should I say. They ran out of space. They couldn't put any more rubbish on site.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking us through that, Nisha. Let's talk to Baroness Sheehan, who is the chair of the Lords Environment and Climate Change Committee, who labelled it a grave environmental hazard. And we are talking about crime here, are we? A waste crime.
Yes. Good morning,
Simon.
And thank you for inviting me. Yes, we are. We're talking about a very serious organised waste crime.
And this is not the only one, the one in Wigan. I know you visited this scene as well, but we also saw that example in Oxfordshire. Shocking pictures of that. And so this is not an isolated incident.
Absolutely not. I have, in fact, visited both sites, Kidlington and the one in Bickershaw. They're not isolated incidents. I think Hodeswood was the first one in Kent that hit the headlines. And I think since then, subsequent reports from the media, all sorts of, and research by the BBC have shown that there's multiple sites of this nature.
Okay, if it is a crime, is this a matter for the police? Is it for the environment agency? Is it for local authorities? What can be done? How can it be enforced?
Well, there is confusion about this. If it's 20 tonnes and under, it's a local authority. If it's above 20 tonnes, it becomes the responsibility of the environment agency. There is that little grey area there. And I think the committee's feeling is that really we should be able to stamp it out before it gets to the size that it has. And we don't understand why these tips are allowed to get to the size that they are when residents report them repeatedly. And then they feel, you know, powerless and scared because neither the Environment Agency or the police or anyone does anything. Nisha's story is a very familiar story, and I do feel for her and the local residents. Having seen that site in Bickershaw, which even on a cold January day stank.
The Environment Agency are taking some measures to tackle the one in Kidlington in Oxfordshire, but at a cost, I think, of nearly £10 million. I mean, that is one reason why sometimes it takes stuff to clear up. It's just incredibly expensive.
It is very expensive, and it really shouldn't get to this point. However, the fact is that both Kidlington and Hodeswood have been designated special cases, you know, and under ministerial direction, the Environment Agency is starting to clear those sites up. This site in Bickershaw is at least as environmentally hazardous, open to fire risks, and this one in particular is really damaging to human and public health. You know, my greatest fear is that we'll see a repeat of the fires that we saw there last year, one of which was designated a major incident, burned for 10 days, and the local primary school had to close because of the toxic fumes.
Okay. Baroness Sheehan, thanks very much indeed. Liberal Democrat peer and chair of the Lords Environment Committee. The Environment Agency gave us a quote saying waste crime scars our communities and we're committed to tackling it in Wigan with local councils and the police as well as across the country.
21 minutes past seven. Plans to allow adults in England and Wales with less than 6 months to live to be helped to end their lives were back in the House of Lords yesterday. Our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran, watched the debate.
Supporters of the plans to legalise assisted dying are worried that the legislation will run out of parliamentary time. The deadline is the King's Speech, which is expected in May. The private members' bill cleared the Commons in June. Members of the Lords are now poring over the details. The bill's sponsor in the upper house, Labour's Lord Faulkner, wants his fellow peers to get a move on.
My experience of this house is that it is able to focus on the things that, let me finish, that we focus on the things that matter, and we should not have taken 9 days to get to clause two.
An opponent of the bill, Lady Alone, who sits as a crossbench or independent peer, thought that criticism was misleading.
There is nothing going on in the course of this bill which is filibustering. It is analysis of the defects and the flaws in this dangerous bill.
A filibuster takes place when parliamentarians seek to delay or talk out proposals they don't like. A Conservative disability rights campaigner insisted that spending time debating potential changes to the bill shouldn't be seen as filibustering. Lord Chinquin feared the draft law would put a price on his head and backed an amendment so that anyone with a congenital, genetic or lifelong condition wouldn't be treated as terminally ill and thus eligible for an assisted death. He wanted supporters of the bill to explain,
why on earth any non-disabled member of this House would presume that as a law-making body, it has either the authority or the credibility, or indeed the legitimacy to reject this amendment. My lords, it has none.
But Labour's Lord Sharmish thought the new amendment was very tough and urged peers to reject it. He spoke about his late brother-in-law who'd suffered from muscular dystrophy.
The problem was, in the later part of his life, his lungs began to give way. And I remember him saying to me in the last two or three months of his life, I just wish somebody could help me here and so that I could end my life. To watch somebody die like that, a member of your close family die from what is a horrendous disease, is something that I hope the House would take into account.
The Lords rarely makes amendments at this stage of proceedings, but later peers did agree to change the bill when they approved proposals supported by Lord Faulkner to introduce safeguards to prevent people with anorexia and others who deliberately stop eating or drinking from qualifying for an assisted death. Last week, the Labour former Lord Chancellor threatened to use the rarely deployed Parliament Acts to override peers' objections. And these amendments would be included if the legislation was reintroduced under that procedure.
That was Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament. The time now is 7:25.
Now, what is going on with Bitcoin? It's the biggest of the so-called cryptocurrencies. It's a digital asset that its fans have long said will revolutionise the world of finance. And thanks to its finite supply, it's a safe haven when governments and central banks print more normal currency, debasing its value. Now, some have likened it to digital gold. One of its biggest fans is Donald Trump, who promised to make the US a crypto haven. And its value rocketed during his first few months in office. But this week, it erased all the Trump-era gains. At one point, it had fallen nearly 50% from its peak before a bit of a comeback yesterday. Dr. Marianne Labor is senior strategist at Deutsche Bank, where she covers payment, digital currencies, financial technology, and all that kind of stuff. She's also a lecturer at Harvard University. She's here in the studio. Good morning to you, Dr. Labor. Bitcoin's always been volatile, but 50% down from its peak, it feels like the faithful, the fans, have lost a bit of faith.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I'm very glad to be here. Yes, it's quite a sharp drop, I would say, but I also feel it's important to look back. And actually, if we look at what happened in 23, one Bitcoin was $20,000. We had this huge exponential rise in 24, 25. And if I look back at 24, we had a couple of big announcements. We have the ETF, which has been approved.
An exchange-traded fund, which means you could buy. It sort of went mainstream at that point.
Absolutely. Like, it's a way of standardizing, by the way, to be able to buy more easily Bitcoin. We had the Bitcoin halving in April.
Okay. That's when it becomes a bit more difficult to get more Bitcoin out of the computers that it sits on.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And President Trump started commenting more and more positively on the industry. He was elected in November. Mm-hmm. And in January 2025, we also had a couple of big announcements, including the Bitcoin Reserve and the Genius Bill, which was signed in July as well.
So all of those things were basically pushing up the value of Bitcoin. And then suddenly we've had, since 125,000 per coin, it went down to 62, 63, quite a big drop. And it's a lot of people said it's meant to be like gold, that when you lose faith in things like paper currencies, like including the dollar, gold does well. Bitcoin was supposed to do well. But in fact, the fortunes of gold and Bitcoin have diverged very sharply. Why?
Very sharply. I mean, you were referring what happened last year in 2025. Bitcoin rose, gold rose by 65%. Bitcoin dropped by 6.5%. A big divergence. And if we look at the factors, they are very, very different. I would say people are buying gold because it's still seen as a safe haven. Central banks have been heavily buying gold as well. For geopolitical reasons, people are buying gold, while for Bitcoin, it was very different, okay. The reason behind.
And what is the, when people do lose faith in fiat currencies, the kind of currency that you can print, I mean, does Bitcoin have a permanent place in the world monetary system now, in your view? Has it basically established itself and it's never going away?
It's a very good question. I think it will coexist for a very, very long time. I don't think it will go away, but it's clearly not a currency. It's clearly not gold, and we've seen that last year. So it won't replace the USD, it won't replace any currency, it won't replace gold. And I see it more as a macro asset class which is maturing. And we've seen that with regulation. We had the Genius Act last year, MiCA in Europe. We should have the Clarity Act coming at some point in the US. We have more and more ETF.
Well, does that kind of regulation and making it mainstream, does that make people feel more comfortable buying it? Or does it put off the people who like the fact that it slightly sits outside the system?
I think it's a mix of both. In order for an asset class to mature, it needs to be regulated. And I really see regulation as a net positive for the industry. If you have regulation, you might have more adoption, consumer adoption, but especially institutional adoption, more liquidity, and in the end, it should drive volatility down.
And it was seen as part of what people called the Trump trade, which is that fan flames, lower interest rates, weaken the dollar if you need to make US exports cheaper. Is that part of the Trump trade falling apart?
I really see like stable coins. It's very different than Bitcoin, by the way. Stable coins.
Let's not go down to the stable coin route. We don't have time for that.
They are money. And I think the Genius Act was a way to address stable coin as a means of payment.
Okay.
And to expand the USD reach. No. I don't see Bitcoin as
okay. Something. But the last word on it, Bitcoin, if you want to jump in there, it is extremely volatile. So do so, with knowing all the risks.
Very volatile, and it's going to stay very volatile.
Okay. Dr. Marion Labor, thank you very much. A senior strategist at Deutsche Bank, thanks for coming in.
7:30, here's Mike Williams with the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Amol. Thank you. Let the games begin.
Welcome to Milano Cortina 2026. Tonight, Italy opens its arms to the world, from the elegance and style of Milano to the alpine wonder of Cortina d'Ampezzo. We welcome you to a land of history and innovation, of creativity, culture and passion.
Bravo, Italia, what a night.
There is no finer Italian sporting anthem, is there, than Nessun Dorma That, the Andrea Bocelli version from that glittering opening ceremony held last night at the San Siro for the 25th Winter Olympics, which are now finally underway in Milan Cortina. So to the sports, loads to look out for today. There are medal events in the women's speed skating, men's snowboard, women's ski jumping as well. You can follow it all on the iPlayer. As to the mixed doubles curling, where Team GB with Jen Dodds and Bruce Moat going really well, 5 wins out of 5 and a win later against either the Canada or the United States. We'll see them reach the final four. So the Olympics are underway, as is the Men's Cricket T20 World Cup. The opening match between Pakistan and the Netherlands is taking place right now in Colombo, and we can get an update live at the stadium. We can speak to Atif Nawaz, who can bring us the latest. Hi, Atif.
Hello there. Yes, it's been a lovely day actually here in Colombo. It's been quite a sort of pleasant start. It's not been a rip-roaring start, but it's been a pleasant start here at the SSC in Colombo. The Netherlands were put into bat earlier by Pakistan, and they made a bright start before falling away and being bowled out for 147, which we think is a below-par score on this very good batting track. Pakistan have made a good start early on, though they have lost one of their opening batters. They're currently 38-1, needing a further 110 to win this match from 98 balls.
And you can hear commentary of that right now over on Five Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. Look out for a couple the Brits in tennis finals later today. British number one Emma Raducanu has reached her first final since winning the US Open in 2021. She'll compete for the Transylvanian Open title later today, whilst Katie Bolter plays in the final of the Ostrava Open. Finally, football, and a big win for Leeds last night.
Peter Banks blows a huge roar. On a mega night, riot breaks out. Leeds United cutting Forest to twigs at times. 9 points clear of West Ham and the bottom three.
Yeah, big night for Leeds, who beat Nottingham Forest by 3-1 at Elland Road. It means Forest in a bit of trouble at the bottom of the table. Leeds, though, as you heard, moved 9 points clear of the relegation zone. Later on 5 Live, you can hear Arsenal Sunderland from 3. That followed by the Six Nations, the big one at Twickenham later. England against Wales from 4:40. Before that, Scotland in Rome to play Italy. But just on the football, Amal and Simon, honorary mention this weekend to 40-year-old James Milner, who will equal the record for most Premier League appearances if he features for Brighton against Crystal Palace tomorrow, 24 years after making his debut. Let's hear it for the oldies, rolling back the years.
Well done, James Milner. Let's talk about tomorrow morning. Paddy O'Connell is on the line. I bet he knows his winter sports.
Well, I'm glad you asked, Simon. We're going to do a test. Can you tell your curling from your skating by sound? It's a question that's not been asked before, I have to say.
Good reason, probably.
There's no need to cast aspersions. Then you're about to speak to Gordon Brown, which is a classic today scoop. For our purposes, we're going to go like this. David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer. Why must it all end in rampant misery? What's the effect of a decade of doom dripped from Downing Street on you listening to Radio 4? We're going to contrast it in sound with 2012, the year of the Jubilympics, but please email me, bh@bbc.co.uk. What's it been like to be told for a decade that your country and your system is broken? Do you agree? Are you fed up? 37 days of rain, we'll talk about that, and we've a radio mystery over Nessun Dorma and Radio 4 to annoy Mike Williams.
We don't want to do that. Paddy, thank you very much indeed. A quick look at the weather. Today will be cloudy for most, with just some bright spells this morning in the southeast and parts of the northwest. I think Puccini would be amazed that every time a sporting event breaks out, Nessun Dorma gets played. The time is 7:25. You're listening today with Amal Rajan and Simon Jack, and Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he greatly regrets bringing Lord Mandelson back into government in 2008. Writing in The Guardian, Mr. Brown says there were no reports at the time of Lord Mandelson having a friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Police are currently looking into claims that Lord Mandelson sent market-sensitive government information to Epstein. Lord Mandelson has previously denied any wrongdoing associated with Epstein. Documents from the release by the US Department of Justice appear to show Lord Mandelson recommended a holiday home in southern Italy in which Jeffrey Epstein could host what he described as guests. A spokesperson for Peter Mandelson said he did not discover the truth about Epstein until after his death. The Liberal Democrats have suspended Lord Renard from the party and opened a new investigation into allegations of harassment made against him more than 10 years ago. In a statement, Lord Renard said the allegations were investigated at the time by police, who took no further action, and an independent lawyer said there was insufficient evidence for disciplinary action against him. But the party says it's received legal advice that the investigation in 2013 was flawed in several respects. Ukraine says Russia has launched what it's called a massive attack on its energy infrastructure. The state grid operator said there were power cuts in most regions. Earlier this week, a Russian attack left hundreds of thousands of people without heating. A 15-year-old boy has been charged with inflicting grievous bodily harm on a teacher at a school in Pembrokeshire. Officers were called to Milford Haven Comprehensive on Thursday afternoon. The boy will also face a charge of possession of a bladed article when he appears at Swansea Magistrates Court later today. The Cabinet Office has started handing out emergency interest-free loans to some of the thousands of recently retired civil servants who have not been paid their pensions. The Public and Commercial Services Union says a backlog of cases has grown since Capita took over the running of the civil service pension scheme in early December. Capita and the Cabinet Office have apologised.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. The time now is 23 minutes to 8. Britain's student loan system is hoving into view, not just as another crisis for this government, but as yet another aspect of the sense of betrayal that many young people in this country feel. In short, the system strikes some, including lots of young people, as being designed to trap them in an ever-increasing cycle of debt and to raise burdens on them at just that moment in their lives when they most need support to do what people in their 20s used to do. Partner up, start a family, maybe build a business, buy a house. The BBC has found that graduates who took out student loans in England after 2012 are paying more of their debt off voluntarily to try to clear what they owe. Analysis of student loans company data suggests voluntary repayments of Plan 2 student loans increased by more than three times between the financial years 2017 and 2025, from 141.7 million to 491.1 million. Hilary Yoha is a 29-year-old graduate who has now repaid all of her student loans. She told us why.
My first 3 years working post-university, I noticed that whilst I was paying towards getting my student loan down, the interest that they were adding on top of that was actually more than what I was paying off. So effectively, my student loan was increasing. So, and then sort of in the last couple of years, my student loan repayments was getting more and more, sort of around £750 was getting taken out of my monthly salary. And at the point at which I paid it off, it was around sort of £11,000 left, which meant that within the next 2 years, I was going to clear off the debt anyway. But if I had just let it sort of run, then there would have been another $1,000 to $2,000 worth of interest. So paying it off when I did last year, March, saved me that additional $1,000 to $2,000 of interest.
Well, it's worth saying, and thank you to Hilary for that, it's worth saying huge numbers of people in their 20s have been coming up with similar stories on the airwaves in recent weeks. But the personal finance expert, Martin Lewis, thinks that high interest has panicked, his words not ours, has panicked some graduates into overpaying. But he warns this is only beneficial for top earners.
So I have met people who have been panicked into overpaying their student loan. And they're just paying off £1,000 or £2,000 when they've come into a little bit of money. But the fact that they have paid off £1,000 or £2,000 will not be enough to change the fact that they won't clear the loan within the 30 years before it wipes. And that means they will not pay a penny less in future because they overpaid by £1,000 or £2,000. That money has been thrown away. And that's my concern about the focus on the interest for some people who won't pay it, that it might scare you into overpaying.
Alan Johnson, former Labour cabinet member, of course, Chancellor of Hull University, was the university's minister when tuition fees were introduced in 2004 and joins us now. Mr Johnson, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you were one of the architects of the original student financing system. What's gone wrong?
Nothing's gone wrong with the original concept, which is that graduates should make a contribution to their higher education. What's gone wrong is we had no real rate of interest. There was no rate of interest applied. The government that came in 2010, including the Lib Dems, who you may remember were going to abolish tuition fees, not only trebled them, they introduced not just a real rate of interest, but RPI plus 3%. RPI, by the way, not CPI. You'll know we measure inflation by CPI. RPI is a higher calculation, plus 3%. So eye-wateringly, those payments went up, and incidentally, they also took away maintenance grants, turned them into a loan. They took away all the taxpayer contribution to higher education. And so those fees, which were part of the cost of a university education, became the total cost of a university education. So once again, we're looking back to those years of Cameron Osborne and saying how many mistakes were made there. But let's not frighten, I agree with Martin Lewis, by the way, let's not frighten people on this, because the whole point of this, it was fine to have a free higher education system when only 2% went to university when I was born, 4% when I left school. If you're going to allow more kids to have the opportunity of a university education, they need to make a contribution. And it's still a world away from credit card debt or mobile phone debt or all the debt that students are used to.
So there's two things. What would a better system look like? And also, what should be done to alleviate this burden right now? So what if Rachel Reeves is probably listening to you right now, what should she do to help the people? You've worked with lots and lots of young people, including those at Hull University, and we've just heard from Hilary Yoha. What can be done to help them now?
Well, the scheme is reasonable and fair, is what the Chancellor of the Exchequer said, and she's absolutely right. What you can do is change that system of the fees going up by such a horrendous amount. You could link it to CPI rather than RPI, and you could remove the 3%. You could change the, you could ensure that the repayment threshold, so students pay nothing, it's graduates that pay once yes. they're earning about 30,000 a year, and then on the basis of 9% above that threshold. So, you know, it's very manageable. It's taken out of your pay by the Chancellor of the Exchequer. You don't have to go anywhere to pay it. But that threshold should be kept in line with earnings, and it's been frozen. So you can do that. You can change the 9% that you pay back, reduce that to, say, 5%, and that would help. But already what this government has done is, thanks to the Education Secretary, is reintroduce maintenance grants for low-income households. Nursing bursaries were reintroduced by the previous government, and that was a good move. They abolished them and then reintroduced them. We've rejoined the Erasmus scheme, and there are and we've linked tuition fees to CPI. They've been frozen since 2017.
It's amazing, though, isn't it? With lots of young people, as you say, we've had a massive expansion of the sector. A lot of young people you speak to lots of them in their 20s, they can't quite believe that even 25 years ago, university was essentially free. You know, what would a better system look like? If everyone agrees, there is now a political consensus that if you go to university, you've got to pay yourself. Yeah, is there a better way of structuring it? So
you've got to make a contribution. Now, look, the simple thing. Look, when I talk to students all the time, it's not students that have a problem with this concept. Mm. In fact, the number of students has gone up. It's not put anybody off. The big debate at the time was that poorer students would be put off, but they don't put anything up front. Their families don't have to contribute anything up front. That's the beauty of this system. Heavily subsidized by the government, by the way, and number of free school meal kids going to university before the introduction of our system, 12%. Number of free school meal kids now going to university, almost 30%.
Okay.
So it hasn't done what people feared
that it would
which
do,
which is put poorer kids off going to
and
university.
And as you say, it is, as it were, a graduate payment because you pay it after you graduate,
exactly.
After you cross
it's
the
world
threshold.
Away from yep. credit card debt as we know it.
All right. Alan Johnson, Chancellor of Hull University, former Labour cabinet member. Thank you very much indeed.
Now, do you have a favourite tree? We learned from the outcry over the felling of the tree in the famous Sycamore Gap that people can have a very close relationship with trees, and an ash tree that stood near the centre of Glasgow for 170 years is in the running for European Tree of the Year. Jim Stevenson lives on Argyle Street.
She's a grand old lady. She's beautiful. She fills me with such joy. She stood there for 170 years, the matriarch of the whole area. She's all green and full of lovely leaves. She's home to quite a few little birds and all that as well.
Well, I'm joined now by David Trainer, an arborist and urban forester. He's looked after this tree for 5 years and first spotted its potential when he nominated it as a wildcard for UK Tree of the Year Awards, David, which I should say it won and is now up against 12 other trees for the European title. What's so special about this tree, David?
Good morning, Simon.
Good morning to you.
Well, this tree is the people's tree. Like you say, it was publicly nominated by me. It's resisting ash dieback, and
that's a disease of the tree, right?
That's correct, yeah. It's a fungi that results in the death of lots of ash trees. Now, we were told that 80% of ash trees would die because of this fungi, and this tree has resisted it. So it's a story of survival, and very much like the Sycamore Gap story you were talking about, it's kind of a counter-narrative to loss, if you like.
Mm. And it also survived the war, survived, you know, urban development, no doubt. I'm just wondering if there is something special about an urban tree.
Well, this tree is very close to the building, and all too often people think that trees and buildings can't coexist. But like you say, this is 170 years old. It's older than the light bulb, older than the telephone, and it's seen everything from horse-drawn trams to electric vehicles.
And is that's the something about it? It's the permanence that basically you think to yourself, gosh, when that was a sapling, the world was a very different place. And that gives it a sort of, there's a sense of time and continuity.
Well, certainly in 170 years, Glasgow has seen massive changes. And what we've noticed about this tree is that the human story is that it's sort of like a reassuring presence, if you like. It's almost like a portal to people's pasts.
Mm.
And it reminds them of their childhood and reconnects the local community.
Like a sort of
stories.
Like a sort of sentinel, actually, having seen many people go by. Is it getting a bit more attention locally now that you've basically, its profile has been raised to UK Tree of the Year and now it's in the European running?
Absolutely. I mean, what we've tried to do is bring all the threads together, and we've got a local community around like a Facebook page, if you like. And through that, people have been able to say, I remember this tree when I was a child. Mm-hmm. My granny used to call it the only tree on Argyle Street. And yeah, it's really brought out all these beautiful stories. My mum and dad met under the tree. When I get a taxi, I tell the taxi driver to drop me off at the big tree on Argyle Street. Yep. So it really has connected people.
And have you had
this family, Simon?
And very quickly, have you had a look at the opposition? What are you up against in this tree war?
Oh, there are beautiful trees, as usual. Some of them are older. Some of them are very beautiful. And, you know, often they're in parks. But what makes this tree unique is that this is an urban tree. It stands out. It shows that there's resilience in the city and survival despite all the change.
All right. Well, good luck to you in the European Tree of the Year. And thanks for telling us all about it, David Trainer there.
12 to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra, an imam and educator.
Good morning. I often end up having conversations about the rising cost of living. Shopping for groceries is costing more and more. Yet we all need to eat. Food is an essential item to sustain life and good health. We are fortunate that in the UK, many of us have plenty. But there are people on our streets who are going hungry. And according to the anti-poverty charity, the Trussell Trust, emergency food provision has risen sharply over the last 5 years. It's also got me thinking about the food that we waste. I read the Quran every day. It warns me not to be wasteful. Eat and drink, but don't waste, it says. It describes wasteful people as brothers and sisters of Satan. Now, I know that may sound a bit harsh, but it's to underline a point. The late Pope Francis equated wastefulness to stealing from the poor. It seems because my family and I have enough, we take things for granted. We appreciate less, and we value less. Turn on a tap, and buckets of water gush out. Fiddle with the hot and cold. Ah, just the right temperature. Meanwhile, several liters of water have gone down the drain, literally. If I, my wife, or any of our children had to walk a mile to fetch a bucket of water on our heads, we would never waste it like this. If we had to ration our food and supplies to last our family a full year until the next harvest, we would never throw away any leftovers. I think of all the restaurants and hotels and the amount of food that ends up in the bins every day. This happens throughout the world. All that food, good food, posh food, sometimes untouched food, wasted. Here's what I will do. I will dish out only what I know I can finish on my plate. Better still, I should dish out a little less, because I can always have a second helping if I need more. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, recommended that the stomach be divided into three parts. One third for food, one third for water, and the final third for air. That is, to stop us from being greedy. A great formula to avoid wastefulness.
That was Thought for the Day with Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra. The time now is 9 minutes to 8.
Now, despite the trauma gripping Westminster at the moment, the business of government goes on, and we know that one of Keir Starmer's top priorities is to bear down on the cost of living. And in that effort, he has appointed a cost of living champion, the executive chairman of Iceland Foods, Richard Walker, Lord Walker, and he's on the line now. Good morning to you, Lord Walker. What brief have you been given?
Morning, Jack. I'm still getting used to that.
Simon, don't worry about that.
Simon.
That's okay, don't worry, I get it a lot.
I'm still waking up. the PM has appointed me his cost of living champion. And I think it's to try and use my experience with Iceland and understanding of our customers to bring some focus and urgency on tackling the cost of living. And I've said to him, I've no interest in producing a long 100-page report with 1,000 recommendations that gathers dust on a shelf, or convening committees or a 10-year plan. What we're looking for is in a sense, we're looking for interventions right now that will make a real difference to
such
to people's
such
pockets.
As what?
Well, we all sort of know what they are in terms of a sense of people. Yes, growing costs, but also a sense of fairness and access to services. So we're going to do a lot of listening at the start, but to give you three examples, things like loyalty traps that penalise you for being a loyal customer, auto renewals, for example. Childcare costs is a huge thing that keeps coming up. I know this from my own workforce, where some of them are having to quit jobs because they can't afford the cost of childcare. And we've got the highest childcare costs in the OECD, or one of. And also the lack of affordable ethical credit. 10% of UK adults now are credit invisible, which forces them instead to the likes of loan sharks, and they become trapped in debt cycles. And that's a huge, pernicious, hidden problem across the UK. So I think there are kind of, you know, key interventions, targeted interventions we can make that will make a real difference right now to people.
I mean, the operative word in this is cost, isn't it? I'm just thinking about major supermarkets, including your own. A lot of people would say, look, you know, like Tesco made £3 billion last year, sacrifice a bit of margin, a bit of profit, actually lower prices, lower the cost of living. Is that something that you would be prepared to do in your business?
Yeah, well, you're right. It is about cost. I mean, just talking generally, but it's also about affordability and real incomes. Now, if you look at food, obviously that's way up there in terms of people's concerns. And I thought the Thought for the Day piece was really interesting. I'm very proud of our business. But if you look at our business, we don't take any dividends. We operate on wafer thin margins. I mean, we didn't make any profit last year. What cash we do make is reinvested. And we employ 30,000 people and pay a ton of tax. So I think we do our bit. But I'm not blind to the fact that, of course, in every sector, including food, there are things that can be done. And, you know, I've made some interventions over the last year or two with regards to the price of infant formula, where we really kind of campaigned on that issue and brought the price down across the industry. And there's certainly specific subcategories we can look at with some cross-sector support where we can try and help.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what you can realistically do, because you've just said childcare costs. Is that, you know, are you going to go to the Chancellor and say you need to subsidise more childcare? You talked about, you know, credit. Are you actually suggesting lending people more money so they can buy basics? Is that really going to get to the heart of the matter?
But there's no magic wand here that I can wave. But what I can do is I'm going to do a lot of listening at the start, but I can absolutely be a pressure point for government. And I've said to them, like, this might be quite uncomfortable for you. I will call stuff out as I see it and be a critical friend. And with, you know, certain interventions, hopefully it'll add up to a golden thread that will make people feel that they've got a few extra pennies in their pocket. But you're right. I mean, it's a massive task. I like a challenge. I climbed Everest 2-3 years ago, and that was very difficult. I think this will be more difficult, but I certainly don't want to be stopped from trying.
You basically last year you gave the government a 6 out of 10 rating, having changed your allegiance to the Labour Party. You've been critical of the pressure that it's put on business. What rating would you give it now?
Well, I'm not going to give a running score line ongoing, but, you know, I think I've made no secret of the fact that some of the choices the government's made, no matter the intention, has impacted business and consumers.
Including things like big rises in the national living wage. That would help the affordability, the cost of living, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose the fact that they're willing to listen to someone like me, they've approached me to use my experience to try and improve things, it does tell me that they're serious about this. I know the Prime Minister's very serious about this, wants to make it his big domestic issue and tackling the cost of living, and that's why I'm here to try and help them.
Okay. Lord Richard Walker, Executive Chair of Iceland's Food and Labour Peer, who's been appointed, as I say, the Prime Minister's Cost of Living Champion. Thanks very much.
3 minutes to 8. Tomorrow we have drama from across the pond.
Radio 4's Story of America.
I know you, Scarlett.
You can buy me as many fine hats as you like,
but I will never need you, Rhett Butler.
In the shadows of the Civil War.
There's no food, there's no money, there's nothing left here but trouble.
An epic tale of love and loss.
Rhett, I'm so sorry.
My darling, I know you didn't love me when we married. Fool that I was, I thought I could change that.
Rhett!
Margaret Mitchell's award-winning novel, Gone with the Wind, begins tomorrow afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Tomorrow is another day.
We heard from Paddy O'Connell wondering what 37 constant days of rain was doing to our psyche. Is it going to be 38? Simon King is at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Simon.
Good morning, Simon. Short answer, yes. It comes perhaps as no surprise to any of us that there is more rain for the weekend. The pressure pattern at the moment means that we've got low pressure to the west of the UK, continuing to bring this rain. And there's no great deal change really for the next few days, but perhaps signs later next week of something a little bit different. But let's talk about today. We've got some rain that's moving its way in across Wales and southwest England. That rain is moving to the north and the east. It'll be followed by some showers. So quite showery, really, into this afternoon. There'll be a few brighter spells with some dry spells as well. So perhaps a chance to dodge the showers if you want to get out and about this afternoon. Maximum temperatures of 7 to 11 degrees. For southeast England, the Midlands and across eastern England, mist and fog patches this morning, those clearing away. Dry for many, but that rain is already moving in from the southwest across southeast England into the South Midlands. Again, it'll push north and eastward. It'll break up as it does so, turning more showery into the afternoon. But again, just an opportunity perhaps of some drier spells with a bit of brightness later on. Highs at 9 to 12 degrees. Northwest and northeast England, again, mist and fog clearing. Some pretty wet weather around the Lake District towards Cumbria and Northumberland this morning. Staying quite drizzly here. Further rain spreads in from the south this afternoon, 6 to 10 Celsius. And for Scotland and Northern Ireland, pretty overcast this morning, pretty damp with rain and drizzle, continuing for many into the afternoon. Still a bit of snow over the Grampians as well, and highs of 4 to 9 Celsius.
Simon, thank you. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Amol Rajan. It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 7th of February. The headlines. The former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has said he regrets appointing Lord Mandelson to his government and accused him of betraying everything we stand for as a country. We'll be speaking to Gordon Brown just after the news. Donald Trump has insisted he didn't make a mistake after a video portraying the Obamas as apes appeared on his Truth Social account. The video has now been removed. The Winter Olympics have opened with four coordinated ceremonies across northern Italy, involving two cauldrons, musical performances and colourful cultural choreography.
Indeed, and coming up this hour, the Winter Olympics, as you say, gets underway in earnest after last night's opening ceremony. We'll be speaking to Dame Catherine Granger, the first woman to chair the British Olympic Association in its 119-year history.
There's this nervous excitement before it starts. Mm. And then when the cauldron is lit and the flags are put up the flagpole, then it feels like it's real. It's time now. It's been a long, long time coming and now it officially begins.
As inflation bites and Japan struggles with rising prices, will the gamble of a snap election pay off for its charismatic first female prime minister?
Takaichi has historically high approval rating. There is sort of an atmosphere of positivity about her being the first female prime minister in Japanese history, being successful at diplomacy.
Good morning from Mike Williams with your Saturday Sport. The opening round of the men's Six Nations continues today. Scotland are in Rome to take on Italy, whilst at Twickenham, England will be heavy favourites to start their title challenge with a win against beleaguered Wales. We will head inside the England camp later and hear from number 8, Ben Earle.
Thank you, Mike. The BBC News this morning is read by Tom Sanders.
The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he greatly regrets bringing Lord Mandelson back into government in 2008. Writing in The Guardian, Mr. Brown says there were no reports at the time of Lord Mandelson having a friendship with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Police are currently looking into claims that Lord Mandelson sent market-sensitive government information to Epstein. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
In his article, Gordon Brown said he wanted to express his revulsion at what has been uncovered about Jeffrey Epstein and his impact on our politics. Mr. Brown writes that he gave Peter Mandelson a job in government in 2008 because he thought his unquestioned knowledge of Europe and beyond could help us as we dealt with the global financial crisis. I now know that I was wrong, he writes. I greatly regret this appointment. Emails released by the US government last week appear to suggest Lord Mandelson, who was business secretary, was sharing sensitive government information with Epstein while Mr. Brown was in Number 10. Met police officers investigating claims of misconduct in public office offences carried out searches at Lord Mandelson's London home yesterday and a country house he uses in Wiltshire. The former Labour peer, who resigned from both the party and the House of Lords this week, has previously denied any wrongdoing. It's understood he believes he has not acted in any way criminally.
Documents from the release by the US Department of Justice appear to show Lord Mandelson recommended a holiday home in southern Italy in which Jeffrey Epstein could host what he described as guests. A spokesperson for Peter Mandelson said he did not discover the truth about Epstein until after his death. Harriet Aggerholm reports.
In an email to Epstein dated August 2010, Peter Mandelson wrote that he'd found the convicted sex offender a great place to stay on the Amalfi Coast. It offered, in his words, privacy, with accompanying rooms for your guests. Quote marks are used around the word guests in the email, although it's unclear which guests are being referred to, and we haven't determined if Epstein went on to stay in the accommodation. The email address the message was sent from has been redacted, but a joint BBC investigation with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism has identified Lord Mandelson. His lawyers said he had no recollection of sending the email. A spokesperson said Lord Mandelson didn't discover the truth about Epstein until after his death, and he was profoundly sorry that powerless and vulnerable women and girls were not given the protection they deserved.
President Trump has said he did not see the section of a video posted on his social media account that depicted Barack and Michelle Obama as apes. After initially defending it, the White House removed it, saying a staff member had posted it by mistake. Here's our North America correspondent, Simi Jolaosho.
Speaking to reporters on Air Force One, President Trump said he only watched the first part of the video that rehashed unproven claims of voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, so he didn't know about the offensive clip it included nearer the end. That part of the video depicted several high-profile Democrats as animals and received widespread condemnation, including from members of his own party, with the only black Republican senator, Tim Scott, describing it as the most racist thing he'd seen out of this White House. The president's spokesperson initially dismissed the backlash as fake outrage, but the video was later taken down. When asked whether he renounced portraying the Obamas as apes, Mr. Trump said, of course, but declined to apologize.
No, I didn't make a mistake. I mean, I look at a lot of thousands of things. I looked at the beginning of it, it was fine.
This is not the first time President Trump has been accused of targeting Barack Obama using racist tropes. He peddled the false Bertha conspiracy theory that President Obama was not born in the U.S., The Obamas are yet to comment on the video.
Ukraine says Russia has launched what it's called a massive attack on its energy infrastructure. The state grid operator said there were power cuts in most regions. Earlier this week, a Russian attack left hundreds of thousands of people without heating. The Cabinet Office says it started handing out emergency interest-free loans to some of the thousands of recently retired civil servants who have not received their pensions since the scheme was taken over by the private firm Capita last December. The PCS union, which represents many civil servants, has described the situation as catastrophic and is calling for urgent action from the government. The Cabinet Office and Capita say they're deeply sorry and have drafted in extra staff to put things right. In an interview recorded for this lunchtime's edition of Moneybox on Radio 4, the president of the PCS union, Martin Kavanagh, said the situation was unacceptable.
It's catastrophic, absolutely catastrophic. I mean, I think most people would accept that this has been an administrative disaster, and people will not understand how any company or any employer could possibly get something so badly wrong.
A 15-year-old boy has been charged with inflicting grievous bodily harm on a teacher at a school in Pembrokeshire. Officers were called to Milford Haven Comprehensive on Thursday afternoon. The boy will also face a charge of possession of a bladed article when he appears at Swansea Magistrates Court later today. The Cabinet Office Minister Josh Simons employed a public relations and lobbying firm to investigate journalist sources before he became an MP. Mr. Simons commissioned the research when he was the chief executive of the think tank Labour Together. He says he wanted to investigate illegal hacking, not journalists. Here's our political investigations correspondent, Joe Pike.
In 2023, the Sunday Times published an investigation about Labour Together, an organisation which was central to helping Keir Starmer become Labour leader. Labour Together had earlier failed to declare more than £700,000 in donations on time and was fined by the Electoral Commission. In response to the Sunday Times' reporting, the think tank employed a PR and lobbying firm, APCO Worldwide. In a contract for the work seen by the BBC, the company confirmed they would investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of the Sunday Times story, as well as upcoming works by two political authors. APCO Worldwide also said they intended to establish who and what were behind what they described as coordinated attacks on Labour Together. Josh Simons, then the think tank's chief executive and now a Labour minister, said it was nonsense to claim he wanted to investigate journalists and he'd actually asked APCO Worldwide to look into a suspected illegal hack. Labour Together and APCO Worldwide have not responded to requests for comment.
The Winter Olympics have officially begun in Italy, with the lighting of the cauldrons in Milan and Cortina taking place last night. A colourful, tightly choreographed opening ceremony was split across four locations, with live celebrations also in Livigno and Predazzo. The main event in the San Siro Stadium in Milan featured the Italian tenor singer Andrea Bocelli. Our correspondent Joe Curry was there.
The 25th Winter Olympics opened with a fitting celebration of sport and the arts. Mariah Carey stole the show with her rendition of the Italian classic Volare. Team GB's athletes, watched by Princess Anne, entered the San Siro wearing hats and scarves designed by the Olympic diver and keen knitter Tom Daly, and were led into the stadium by the ice skater Lila Fear. Team USA were clapped in by Vice President JD Vance, cheered by some of the crowd.
I think you've got a mixed reception, Hazel. Don't want to be contentious.
Now that the Games have officially opened, the first Olympic medals will be won this weekend. Later today, Team GB's curlers will look to maintain their unbeaten run in the mixed doubles, whilst Kirsty Muir goes in qualifying for the women's freeski slopestyle.
An ash tree on a busy street in Glasgow is in the running to be named European Tree of the Year. The tree will take on a dozen others from across the continent for the title. At about 170 years old and 75 feet tall, it survived the Blitz, redevelopment and a destructive fungal disease. From Glasgow, our correspondent Jamie McIver reports.
The tree is a great survivor. It stands in a residential part of Glasgow's famous Argyll Street and predates the invention of the light bulb and the telephone. 5 years ago, it was saved from ash dieback disease. Last autumn, it won the Woodland Trust's UK Tree of the Year contest, and now it's Britain's entrant for the European title. There are 12 other trees from a number of countries in the running. Voting through an online poll is open for another fortnight.
Jamie McIver reporting.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's now 8:10. In 2008, as Prime Minister, amid the great financial crash, Gordon Brown brought Peter Mandelson back to the very top of British politics. Serious people are needed for serious times, was the line back then. Many counselled against. William Hague said it was a stunning failure of judgment. On September the 10th last year, one day before Peter Mandelson was sacked as the UK ambassador to Washington, Gordon Brown asked the Cabinet Secretary to investigate the disclosure of confidential and market-sensitive information by Mandelson when he was Prime Minister. Last night, The Guardian published an article by Gordon Brown with the headline, "We owe it to Epstein's victims and to British democracy to demand historic change." Gordon Brown joins us now. Mr. Brown, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Naturally, we've made plenty of time for this. I'm very keen we go through it methodically and in three parts, so past, present, future. First, your reaction to the revelations from the period 2008 to 2010. Second, what this means for Keir Starmer's government. And third, I know your Guardian article's got many recommendations for how we clean up public life today. We will get there. But first, let's talk about the past. Do you now accept that you made an error of judgment in bringing Peter Mandelson back?
Yes, I've said that, and I made mistakes. I regret it. It shouldn't have happened. I think people have got to understand the circumstances in which I made that mistake. But let me say, first of all, that Mandelson did betray us. But most of all, the biggest betrayal was of the women and girls that were trafficked, that were exploited, that were treated as less than human by Epstein and by Mandelson, who became one of his enablers. And we are talking, and I hope we'll deal with this, about a global network of wealth and power that felt it could act with complete impunity. And of course, we owe it to those victims, those girls who cruelly suffered and have not yet had justice, that every action we take is rooting out the power of those people who made these powerless women subject. And I want to support, by the way, Theresa May's efforts, because this is modern slavery. And I've been working with her on certain occasions so that we root out the sexual trafficking, the modern slavery, the exploitation of girls. And there is not a proper system of investigation, prosecution, imprisonment of these sexual traffickers now, even now, and something's got to be done about that.
We certainly will talk about that. And I know you've got some specific recommendations which people can find in your Guardian article. We'll get there. Let's talk about some of the things that you've learned in the recent weeks from the Epstein files. What was your reaction, Mr. Brown, when you discovered that Peter Mandelson was forwarding on internal Downing Street messages from your special advisor, Nick Butler, particularly on forthcoming asset sales to get UK debt down, and forwarding those messages to Mr. Epstein?
Shocked, sad, angry, betrayed, let down. You can say all these things. And even now, I find it completely incomprehensible that this could have happened and it couldn't be spotted. When I asked in September about the sale of assets, because I'd seen that the Royal Bank of Scotland's assets, which had been sold to JP Morgan, seemed to have involved conversations between Mandelson and Epstein. I asked the department through the permanent secretary, the cabinet secretary, what they knew of the communications between Mandelson and Epstein. And it is quite amazing that even now I could get a letter back saying there was no record of any communications between Epstein and Mandelson, when we know, of course, there were. And what is absolutely clear is that there was a failure in registration of calls and communications. There was obviously private email systems bypassing the official systems. If Mandelson did stay in the house of Epstein during the time he was in prison, then as business secretary, it should have been registered that on a business venture to the United States of America for official business, he was staying in a private home. So all that stuff should have been available and should be available. And so there is a systems failure that's got to be addressed, okay, and addressed immediately. And
I want to ask about something else very specific as well, which is that you are, of course, for many years, the Chancellor. What was your reaction on discovering recently that Mr. Mandelson had suggested pressure be applied to the then Chancellor, the late Alistair Darling, by Mr. Epstein or indeed JP Morgan on the issue of a banker's bonus tax?
Well, here's a person who's betraying his country. I mean, we are trying to act in the best interest of the country. Alistair, to his great credit, and I was resisting the pressure of bankers that the bonuses somehow not be taxed or be taxed at a far more lenient rate. And here was a cabinet minister encouraging a private banker who stood to benefit from this to threaten the Chancellor. Now, I think it's clear that we resisted that pressure. I too was phoned up by bankers wanting a release from this, saying it would damage the British banking industry for good and everything else. But we resisted this. And by the way, so it's clear, we brought in during the financial crisis four special advisors who could bring expertise. We were dealing with a global financial crisis. I needed people who knew what was happening in other countries and could investigate it and work with the governments of other countries. We brought in Lord Davis. We brought in Paul Miners, both of whom had been chairman of important companies. We promoted Shriti Vadira, who's now the chairman of Prudential. Some people were rejected when we were looking for people to help us because of conflicts of interest. And Mandelson, of course, did appear. I talked to the commission to have an unblemished record as the Trade Commissioner for 4 years. And of course, I just repeat, nobody had ever heard of Epstein in the government, and nobody knew of any friendship between Epstein and Mandelson at that time. That was completely something that was unknown to us. So we were bringing in people. We had to do it. We were solving a major financial crisis. To be honest, all my thoughts were on how we could save people's jobs and savings and their livelihoods. And perhaps in the rush to do that, we made some mistakes. And I do acknowledge that. But I think people will understand the context in which we were working.
We will get onto your proposals for making sure that that sort of thing doesn't happen again. Just before we get there, a couple of other points on what happened between 2008 and 2010 that we've discovered. It appears that Peter Mountain passed on information confirming that there was going to be a bailout in Europe. Just to be very clear on that specific point, why, in your judgment, was that A, wrong, and B, market sensitive?
Well, it's market sensitive because people can trade in any currency almost at any time. And if something is happening to the euro, which affects the pound and affects the dollars, then people can short, people can do all sorts of things to make money out of a particular situation. And even a matter of minutes in divulging information can make a difference to people's ability to make money speculatively. So there is no doubt that this would be seen as a financial crime if the police were investigating it, or I see it as a financial crime, and there's no doubt that that was very dangerous. Okay. And look, all the information he passed on, the papers by other advisors, were commercially sensitive. This was financially secret information. It meant that Britain was at risk because of that. The currency was at risk. Some of the trading that would happen would be speculative as a result of that. And there's no doubt that huge commercial damage could have been done and perhaps was done.
One other specific point about what we discovered in recent weeks. On his podcast, Political Currency, with George Osborne, your longtime friend and colleague Ed Balls said the following. He conveyed a sense of betrayal. He said, "We were thinking we were fighting the next election. We were trying to beat you," i.e. George Osborne. "We were trying to deal with the aftermath of this global financial crisis. Peter was overtly planning the next stage of his career." Do you share that sense that that is what Peter Mountain was doing while you were fighting the global financial crisis?
Well, the emails show that. They show that he was talking about writing a book while he was supposed to be a government minister. He was talking about how he would get a job after the government was over, and talking about what banks would employ him. All these things were happening at one and the same time. So it was a complete betrayal of his colleagues and of the job that he was carrying out. And, of course, it was a betrayal of the country. Now, I do think there are measures we can take to prevent this happening in future, and I would like to talk about them. There's been a systems failure, and we've got to rectify it, and I think it can be done. But look, this is information that was 15 years old that is now becoming available to us, and it's remarkable that our checks and balances in the system have not found out about this before now.
Final thought on 2009. Did Peter Mountain, or indeed 2008, did Peter Mountain express to you, because it was a surprise to lots of people that you brought him back, did he have any conditions on accepting the job?
No conditions, but of course I had conditions that he would behave properly. Okay. And I did check up with the head of the commission that he had a record of good service. As trade commissioner, of course, his expertise in knowing countries around the world and what was happening to the economy was important, but it does not excuse the mistake I made. You've got to be honest in politics and admit where you get it wrong, and I got it wrong.
What about the mistake that Keir Starmer thinks he made? I want to ask you about Keir Starmer's judgment. There are lots of people who say that Keir Starmer's position, which is he says he was lied to, is intellectually and morally inadequate. Not just because the vetting that was undertaken on Peter Mountain made very, very clear to Keir Starmer before the appointment of Mountain as ambassador that the relationship with Epstein was ongoing, but also because there was a huge amount in the public domain. For instance, the Financial Times reported in June 2023 that Mountain stayed at Epstein's Manhattan townhouse while Epstein was in prison for soliciting prostitution from a minor. In your judgment, was Keir Starmer not just wrong but foolish to appoint him ambassador?
You see, the last point is disputed by Mandelson publicly, and this is the issue. There is a record of saying that he was planning to stay in that house. There is no record that he actually stayed in that house. And the department should have had that record, and I don't know if they do, but they certainly haven't given it to me. Look, Keir Starmer was misled and he was betrayed, and of course that is not a sufficient explanation for what happened. There is a systemic failure to do proper vetting, to go through the proper procedures, and to actually have, in my view, what should be public hearings for anybody who is going to be in a senior position representing the British government. They do it in America. We do it for even the members of the Monetary Policy Committee have got to come before the House of Commons for hearings. We didn't do it for Mandelson. So the private vetting is one thing. There should have been public hearings, as the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee recommended, so that people could ask the questions of Mandelson and see whether he was indeed the liar that he has now been seen to be.
But there's a huge number of people, you know this, Mr. Brown, because they're no doubt contacting you as well. There's a huge number of people in the Parliamentary Labour Party, in and around Number 10, briefing newspapers to say they think that Keir Starmer's judgment was hopeless. What's your view of the decision he made to appoint Peter Mandelson as ambassador to Washington?
Well, he has clearly said it was the wrong decision, and it was the wrong decision. Just as I made a mistake, he made a mistake. But equally, I think you've got to say of Keir Starmer that there's very few people that you can say have got the same amount of integrity as Keir Starmer has. He was director of public prosecutions, did a brilliant job. He's a serious man who wants to do the right thing in British politics. If he made a mistake, he owns up to it. But I think the question now for Keir Starmer is, is he prepared and will he be prepared to bring in the reforms that are necessary to end these abuses? What we're dealing with is the abuse of power. We're dealing with the systematic abuse of power by lobbyists, by people who are corrupt, by people who don't give proper information when they're asked to disclose information. We're dealing with a lack of transparency in the system, all these things. And by the way, I did a report for Keir recommending all that this be done. And this is the report that should be taken up. There are four areas where we need to make major reforms. They could be done within weeks with the support of members of parliament in the House of Commons. And I believe it would be possible. We could start to clean up the system from tomorrow, but it's got to be done.
Okay, let's talk about justice for the survivors of Epstein's abuse, and then maybe, if we've got time, we'll come back to the Labour Party. On two specific points, aside from the police investigation now underway, if Peter Mandelson is called to give evidence in Washington, should he go?
Of course. We've got to be as open as possible about everything we know about sexual trafficking, about the abuse of women, and about the abuse of power. And look, we're dealing with a global network of very powerful people who believed that they could break the law. They believed they could do anything because nobody would prosecute them. Nobody would interrogate them. Everybody would treat them as good people who should never be challenged on what they do. And so we've got to get to the bottom of this. I've no doubt this is still happening. I've no doubt that sexual trafficking is prevalent. I've no doubt that the abuse by people in very senior positions is continuing. And that's why Peter Mandelson, that's why, to be honest, Prince Andrew, or ex-Prince Andrew, and anybody who knows anything about this has got to give the information to the authorities that will allow us to see what we can do to root out what is the most egregious abuse of power. Vulnerable young women exploited, trafficked, treated as less than human by people who knew they had the power over them because they had both wealth and they had influence. And that is something that is completely unacceptable. And it makes everybody, I think, who knows about this, all decent people, angry, particularly mothers about what's happened to their girls and what's happened to their daughters as a result of this egregious abuse of power.
You mentioned that you published a major report commissioned by Keir Starmer. It was called A New Britain. It's 155 pages long. It's about constitutional reform, partly with a view to not just improving Britain's democracy, but rooting out corruption and lobbying, as you see it, which is a major problem of cancer in our body politic, I think, is how you see it. What happened to that report?
Some of it's being implemented and was in the Labour manifesto and is still to be implemented. We've got a change in the ministerial code. We've got a change in the role of the ethics advisor. We've got an attempt to devolve a lot of power from quite a secretive parts of Whitehall. We've got a new attack on corruption. But look, the things that need to be done are these. The first thing is you need an anti-corruption commission to look at what's happening in the public sector with powers to seize assets, to root out corruption proactively. And that is not happening yet. And that should happen. We've got an anti-corruption champion, just as you've got a standards of living champion. But you need someone with the powers to act. She's doing well, but we need the powers that will allow that anti-corruption commission to act. And the second thing is ethical standards. We don't do well enough in imposing standards on members of parliament, on ambassadors, but also on government ministers. You should have the power if you're the commissioner dealing with this, and we do need this ethics commission to be given statutory powers to check bank accounts, for example. I mean, if you're appointing someone and there's some question mark over financial propriety and they're in a senior position and you don't check their bank accounts when you've got a suspicion, then that is something that is completely unacceptable. So that should be a power that is given to deal with ethics. politics. Lobbying is one of the most egregious things that has got to be dealt with. You know, there are 91 people who are giving political advice for payment in the House of Lords. So these are the legislators who are getting money to pay to advise those who are trying to stop legislation. There are 50 people in the House of Lords who are lobbyists. It's a completely unacceptable situation, and it's got to be dealt with immediately. It's like a rotten borough of 91 people who are able to influence legislation at the same time voting on the things that they're trying to stop.
Do we need a total ban on MPs' second jobs?
I believe so, except in the circumstances where, for example, you've got a medical qualification that's got to be kept going if you're a doctor and want maybe to practice in the future. But yes, I've always supported that. We should have done it long ago. We tried to do it after the expenses scandal. There was a lot of resistance to it. Keir Starmer has announced that he supports that kind of ban, and I think it should be done. Now, I'm not criticising the vast majority of members of the House of Lords or MPs. They are public servants who want to serve the public, but they are brought down by the behaviour of people who use positions of power purely for financial gain and in some cases for sexual gratification, who are abusing the system, who are making a mockery of what is should be a dignified public service.
The penultimate line, or in fact the final line of your Guardian article says, the time is overdue to let in the light and send the princes of darkness on their way. It was David Cameron who said in response to various issues or scandals on transparency and lobbying, let sunshine win the day. You can see, can't you, Mr. Brown, why the public are extraordinarily tired of these scandals, and it's quite hard to convince them that MPs are serious about improving democracy.
Yeah, this is an issue of trust, and trust once dented is difficult to recover. And that's why we need a comprehensive set of actions on corruption, ethics, lobbying, and indeed on openness. There should be public hearings, as I said, when you have senior appointments. Now, that is contained in recommendations we put forward some time ago. The government should be committed to bringing these forward because much of it is in the manifesto. They've got to bring it forward immediately. It should be a comprehensive bill to deal with corruption, ethics, lobbying and secrecy. And if we don't do that in the next few months, we will pay a heavy price. And I am certainly urging Keir Starmer, who's got a great record in wanting to do these things, and as Director of Public Prosecution, he is actually the man to bring this forward, the leader who can do this. And I believe there would be a massive parliamentary majority for taking this action immediately. There is no doubt now of what we need to do, and it's got to be done. And, you know, when David Cameron said he was going to change it, he had a lobbying act. Only 4% of the lobbyists are covered by this act. And so this is a ridiculous attempt at trying to do something and failing to do it. We've got to do it properly this time, and it's got to be done systematically, and it's got to be done now. And I would suggest that in the next 3 months, this legislation has got to be brought forward so that we deal with this crisis immediately. And people see that we know mistakes have been made. We know we've found out now things we never had found out. Even 15 years old information has been brought to bear in the last few weeks, and we've got to act on it. And if we don't act with urgency, then we will all, and I'm not just talking about one political party, all people in public life will pay a heavy price if we fail to take up what is obviously things that need to be done and done with urgency.
You say that Keir Starmer is the man to do it, that he's got the track record and also the integrity. It's very, very clear, looking at the reporting around this morning, that there are concerted efforts and a strong sentiment amongst your Labour colleagues and those in the Parliamentary Labour Party now to look at whether or not he should be removed. What's your message to the Labour Party about whether or not Keir Starmer should remain the Prime Minister of this country?
Well, this is obviously serious. I mean, there's always speculation. It happened to me. It happened to Tony Blair. It happens to everybody about how their future should be gauged. But this is serious, and the task is very clear. The task is we've got to clean up the system, a total cleanup of the system, an end to the corruption and unethical behaviour. And if we don't do it, we'll pay a heavy price.
But a leadership challenge would be a distraction, in your view.
Well, I do say Keir Starmer is the man who commissioned this report. I worked with him. I know he wants to do this. Look, the government is concentrating rightly on standards of living and on getting growth into the economy, but it's the culture here. Now, one famous American senator said, culture is far more important than people realise, but cultures can change, and it's our job to change the culture, which has allowed secrecy, unethical behaviour, unjustified commercial gain from unregulated lobbying and corruption to enter into our system. Britain must become the most transparent, the least corrupt political system in the world, and we've got a duty to act now.
To be clear, final thought on this, why, if he made such a big error of judgment in his view and your view in appointing Peter Mandelson to that job in Washington, is Keir Starmer the right man to lead this Labour government? He's clearly in a situation where his number 10 operation, the political operation, has lost control of the Parliamentary Labour Party, to put it mildly, and he's clearly in a position where other people are getting ready for a leadership challenge that could come before or could come after the May elections. Given all of that, why is he the right man to take this country forward?
I know the man. Look, in other prime ministers, you've been questioning their integrity. You've been questioning whether they are guilty of some unquestionable mistakes in terms of their personal finances and their personal lobbying and everything else. This is not the case for Keir Starmer. You know, I can look in his eyes and I can see that he is a man of integrity. He wants to do the right things. Perhaps he's been too slow to do the right things, but he must now do the right things now. And let's judge what he does on what it happens in the next few months when he tries to, and I believe will try, to clean up the system.
Gordon Brown, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
It is 27 minutes to nine. Let's catch up with Adrian Charles, because Saturday Live is coming up. Have you got a favourite winter sport, Adrian?
I'm very much in favour of the...
Curling?
To do.
Biathlon?
Ski jump. Ski jump. Never want to do it, but after what I've read this week...
There's some controversial ways to get ahead in ski jumping in the papers.
Let's not get into that, but it's given me a renewed fascination. You would have thought there was enough jeopardy in the actual jump than bothering with that stuff. Anyway, let's not get into that. On Saturday Live this week, we've got three fantastic guests. We've got Mackenzie Crook, renowned actor, obviously, performer, comedian. As a writer, he came up with The Detectorists, big hit, amazing piece of work. If I'm any judge, he's got another hit on his hands with something brilliant called Small Profits. Michael Palin's in it, and he's brilliant. Mackenzie's just given himself a little part in it, but a wonderful piece of work. That's about to drop, as they say, on iPlayer. Someone else with many strings to their bows, Alexander Armstrong. Look forward to speaking to him, another great actor and comedian who says he really just lives to write, and that's what he's done with his latest book, Even for the Tempest Stone. Then we've got the remarkable Patricia Wiltshire. She's a forensic botanist whose expertise in pollen has helped law enforcement put away perpetrators of some really awful crimes. She's a fantastic talker. Really look forward to speaking to Patricia. And we have Katie Pritchard, a contender in the National Pun Championships, and the inheritance tracks of Riz Ahmed.
Wonderful. Adrian, look forward to that. Thank you very much indeed. Quick look at the weather. Today will be cloudy for most, with just some bright spells this morning in the southeast and parts of the northwest.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Roger and Simon Jack. And at 25 to 9, let's get a summary of the news from Tom Sanders.
The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has told this programme he made mistakes when bringing Lord Mandelson back into government in 2008, and said Lord Mandelson did betray us. Mr. Brown said when Lord Mandelson was appointed as the UK's ambassador to the US, the government had failed to do proper vetting. He said there was a system failure that needed to be rectified, for example, by having public hearings before such appointments. Documents from the release by the US Department of Justice appear to show Lord Mandelson recommended a holiday home in southern Italy in which Jeffrey Epstein could host what he described as guests. A spokesperson for Peter Mandelson said he did not discover the truth about Epstein until after his death. Lord Mandelson has previously denied any wrongdoing associated with Epstein. President Trump has said he did not see the section of a video posted on his social media account that depicted Barack and Michelle Obama as apes. After initially defending it, the White House removed it, saying a member of staff had posted it by mistake.
Thanks very much, Tom. Let's get some sport and rugby on the agenda today, Mike.
Yes, Simon, the opening round of the Six Nations continues later today. Scotland are in Rome to face Italy this lunchtime. You can watch that on BBC TV. After that, England will be heavy favourites to start their campaign with a win against beleaguered Wales. Well, I've been inside the England camp this week. I actually went down to Twickenham yesterday after the programme and spoke to the Saracens number 8, Ben Earl, who is proving to be one of the form players in Steve Borthwick's side.
And Ben Earl's got a run in from 40. Here goes the number 8. What a try! What a moment for Ben Earl! The trademark thumbs up celebration!
Ben Earl, here we are then, almost showtime. What's the mood in the camp with just, what, a few hours to go now until kickoff against Wales?
Yeah, I think excitement, obviously, anticipation of what's to come. I think getting a taste of the game last night was pretty cool. Seeing the standard that's required to win a Six Nations game. You know, for some people, this is the first time they're sort of playing in this tournament. You know, the other end, you've got boys that have played, I think George Ford's played something like 14 campaigns or something crazy like that. So, yeah, we've got a good blend, but excitement, boys just can't wait to get going.
What did you make of that tournament opener in Paris? Holders looking pretty good, aren't they?
Yeah, very good. That was like I thought that was like the French way, epitomised, feeding off sort of loose passages of play, coming up with just moments of genius, individual genius and collective. I thought they were brilliant. I thought they were tactically spot on and capitalised where Ireland were a bit vulnerable.
I know you're going to tell me we don't look too far ahead, but having seen perhaps Ireland are maybe not at their best, are there some thoughts already creeping into this England camp thinking that, well, we've got the measure of Ireland, this is probably going to be a two-horse race now between England and France, and it could all come to that Grand Slam decider in Paris in week 5?
Well, I think you've got to remember we haven't won at Murrayfield since 2020. There's that to contend with. There's a game tomorrow where Wales are like sort of where we were, if I was to put myself in the shoes, like we were not too far away from that sort of at the beginning of the World Cup, and I remember how hungry we were and how keen we were to sort of upset the bookies and the fans and to show that we've got a bit of fight about us. So it wasn't too long ago we were in their shoes. So yeah, I think it is unfortunately the cliche answer of one game at a time, because this game is a very funny way of biting back when you think in 3 or 4 weeks ahead.
Great try from Ben Earl, seventh for his country, and that may be the pick of the bunch.
A word on Wales. I know the adage is there's no easy games in the Six Nations, but on paper, this will be the easiest game that you face in this Six Nations. Wales, just 2 wins in 2.5 years. England won 11 on the spin. I see with one bookies, Wales are 25-1 to win in a two-horse race. How do you and this England side guard against complacency?
Well, I think we've sort of held ourselves to a standard now from the autumn, you know, from the summer and the Six Nations before. We've got a level of performance that we expect within ourselves. We've got metrics that we want to hit within our group. And I do think, like, obviously, oppositions come and pose different challenges, but our big thing is about getting our game on the pitch. I think if we're not too far away from that, the result will be the result. But we've got our own sort of standards to uphold, and I think we've got to keep trying to show the fans here at the Allianz what kind of team we want to be. And we've got a good opportunity for that tomorrow.
And this England side are really hitting their stride, aren't they, after perhaps a bit of a transitional period under Steve Borthwick. Now, as we say, 11 wins on the spin, this England side are really walking tall.
Well, we're in good form for sure, and we know we're learning a lot about each other week in, week out. The more time we spend together, the better I feel like we're playing and we're going to play, so that can only be a good thing. But like you say, like, almost the slate's again wiped clean, like it was in the autumn, like it was over the summer. We've got to start again, write our own story again, so that's been a big narrative for us.
Pre-match rituals for yourself here at Twickenham ahead of a big England-Wales game, regardless of how the form of both sides are, this is always a big game. What's the final few hours before kickoff look like for Ben Earl?
I'll be getting off my feet, and I'm actually doing a Masters, so I've got to do some catch up. So that'll be me this afternoon. I'll be heading the books.
Oh, nice. Masters in?
Sports directorship from Manchester Met. So I've got a few bits on governance this afternoon, which is about as dry as it gets. But yeah, we've got some bits to do.
Brilliant. Well, good luck for the game against Wales and indeed for the rest of the tournament. Thanks for speaking to us.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
The studious Ben Earl speaking to me yesterday. Thanks for his time. He part of the England side that take on Wales at Twickenham. Kick off 4:40. You can hear the whole match live on BBC Sounds.
Thanks very much indeed, Mike. Let's keep the sporting theme going because the Olympic flame is burning once again. The Milan Cortina Winter Olympic Games are officially underway after last night's opening ceremony, split across four locations with Milan's San Siro Stadium as the focus. I say the Olympic torch is burning. Actually, two Olympic cauldrons were lit, one in Milan, the other in Cortina, with the Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli performing a rousing rendition of Nessun Dorma. What else? As the torch entered the stadium, the BBC sports correspondent Joe Curry was watching.
Dichiaro aperta la celebrazione della quindicesima edizione dei Giochi Olimpici Invernali Milano Cortina.
At Milan's San Siro Stadium, 1,200 performers came together to open the 25th Winter Olympics in a stylish ceremony. It featured sections labelled Italian Beauty and Fantasia, with an appearance from MotoGP icon Valentino Rossi and a tribute to the fashion designer Giorgio Armani, who passed away last year.
From ancient Rome through the Renaissance, from art and literature, architecture, design, fashion, food and festivals like the 900-year-old Carnival of Venice, our host nation always does things with style.
And a time when so much of the world is divided by conflict, your very presence demonstrates that another world is possible.
American singer Mariah Carey, one of the world's best-selling female artists, was decked out in a sparkling white outfit as she performed a version of the Italian classic Volare. And Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli performed a rousing rendition of Nessun Dorma as the Olympic flame entered the stadium.
Great Britain.
Team GB's athletes, watched on by Princess Anne, entered the San Siro wearing hats and scarves designed by Olympic diver and keen knitter Tom Daly, and were led out by the skater Lila Fear.
Ukraine.
Ukraine.
But the warmest welcome was reserved for the Ukrainian athletes, whilst Team USA were also loudly cheered. But there were boos for US Vice President J.D. Vance, with negative crowd reactions for the Israel and Georgia teams as well. With over 3,500 athletes competing for 116 medals over the next 2 weeks, Milano Cortina is expected to be the biggest Winter Olympics to date.
Bravo, Italia, what a night. Let the games begin.
Joe Curry reporting there. Well, if you've been following the footage or the coverage on BBC, you'll know that events including curling, figure skating and ice hockey have already begun. But today is a big day as the first five gold medals of the Games will be decided later. Earlier, I spoke to Dame Catherine Granger, the first female chair of the British Olympic Association. She was, of course, the only British woman to win medals in five successive Olympic Games. She's in Milan for the Games. I asked her what last night was like.
Opening ceremony is just where it all begins, isn't it? So it's going to be a mix of incredible display, all the athletes marching, music, cheering, some very interesting interpretive dance and movement. And the whole thing is just, there's this nervous excitement before it starts. Mm. And then when the cauldron is lit and the flags are put up the flagpole, then it feels like it's real. It feels like it's genuinely, it's time now. It's been a long, long time coming and now it officially begins.
There's something special about the Winter Olympics, isn't there, in the sense that we all suddenly become quite interested in sports that we don't see that often.
I think we don't just become interested. I think we all become armchair experts almost overnight. And suddenly we're, you know, advising our own curling teams on their tactics and judging how our figure skaters land after the triple salchow, thinking, is that good or not? So I think there's an excitement, there's a thrill, it's incredibly impressive what these young athletes do.
What is it reasonable for GB to your team GB to expect?
Well, we've already put out UK Sport has sort of set a medal range that's expected between 4 and 8 medals. Now, the most we've ever won in our Winter Games is 5, so it shows the potential of this team. And it's not just, it, I think what's really impressive with this team is we've got it across a really wide range of sports. So from skeleton to freestyle and curling to bobsleigh, we've got amazing figure skaters. We've got this real amazing array of talent.
A lot of attention on Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson, who are being talked about as the next Torvald and Dean. I think actually Lila Fear was involved in Carry the Flag.
Yes, Lila walked into the stadium last night, into the San Siro, waving the Union flag. And they have recently been competing in Sheffield at the European Championships, and they are here now. And yes, Torvald and Dean is often mentioned in the same bracket, and that was 1984 when we last saw Bolero and British talent on the podium. So they are always talked about as the next Torvald and Dean. They are, you can see how time has changed. It's a very different style, very dramatic dance they've got. They're a great dynamic pair. They're so impressive on ice.
And other medal hopes that we, you know, household names to be?
Yes, there will be. So we've got Matt Weston in the skeleton. Now he's reigning champion in that event, and he'll be shortly taken to the sliding track. And we've got a good history in skeleton. We've got some great names that have gone from the past. Right now, we've already had 2 days of curling. Mixed curling started before the opening ceremony began. So Ruth Bowett and Jen Dodds are in our mixed curling team. They are the only team at the moment in that event to have won 5 out of 5 of the rounds they've done so far. So in the round robin stage, and they're unbeaten. So that's very exciting. They've got some big competition ahead, but they're great. And then we take to the ski slopes, and we've got Mia Brooks and Kirsty Muir and Charlotte Banks. We've got this incredible array of women again, Zoe Atkin, who are already medalling on the international slopes. And now we're going to see it for real at the Winter Olympics. So yeah, I think we've got some great names that people remember long after this moment.
And how does the relationship between funding and performance work? I remember in 2012, you know, you were there, of course, and there was a real focus on trying to get a big medal haul. Funding was allocated on a, you know, where we've got the best chance. How does it work in something like this?
It's an interesting one. So UK Sport funding body sets the, they've got a really strong relationship day in, day out with all the different sports, and an ongoing conversation about not just the potential of the athletes, you know, how they run their programmes. There's governance is included. There's lots of sort of mathematical equations and discussions put into how much each sport will then receive. And then what is actually done increasingly and happening now is that the allocation of to each sport is actually decided before the Olympic Games and before the Paralympic Games as well. So it's to try and take away the pressure of it all comes down to this moment.
And finally, the Olympic movement. I mean, I know there were a few boos. People were interpreting it being JD Vance last night, but does sports still play this important role in bringing people together?
So we had it was a reasonably lengthy opening ceremony last night, which was wonderful. And Kirsty Coventry is the new IOC president of the International Olympic Committee. And, you know, she does an opening speech. And throughout her tenure so far, a lot has been mentioned of this idea that sport is designed to bring countries together, bring nations together, bring individuals together. It's about friendship and respect, which are two of the Olympic values. So yes, it's about these incredible sporting moments and performance, but sitting behind it and sort of the platform that rests on is the idea that it should be about harmony. You know, last night's theme in the stadium was about harmony.
Dame Catherine Gager, thank you very much indeed, Chair of the British Olympic Association. And you can watch the Winter Olympics and become an armchair expert in all these sports across BBC One and BBC Two from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. That's 13 hours each day. An Olympics Extra live stream will also be available on BBC iPlayer and the BBC Sport website as well for extended coverage. Now then, Japan heads to the polls again this Sunday. This is the second general election in as many years. Prime Minister Sanae Takeuchi, Japan's first female leader, is betting on her personal popularity to do what her party failed to achieve last year, secure a clear mandate for the long-ruling but unpopular Liberal Democrat Party. But Sunday's elections will test appetite for her plans to boost public spending when inflation and the cost of living is top of voters' minds. Our Tokyo correspondent, Jamila Khalil, has been speaking to voters about what's at stake.
It's another cold morning in Tokyo. Here in Togoshi Ginza, a busy shopping street in central Shinagawa, daily life is in full swing. Mothers are cycling past with shopping baskets up front and children strapped behind. An elderly woman is examining a bag of oranges at a fruit stall outside the local supermarket. Japan is heading into a snap election, its second in 2 years. The Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, caught her party, the opposition, and much of the electorate here off guard when she called it just 3 months into her leadership. It's a political gamble, one her predecessor, Shigeru Ishiba, took last year and lost badly. This time, the difference is her persona and popularity. Her party's image, though, remains deeply tainted by corruption scandals that came to light over 2 years ago. The timing of this election has drawn sharp criticism. Opponents say it will delay anti-inflation measures and budget scrutiny. It's also happening in the depths of winter, with heavy snow in parts of northern Japan raising concerns about turnout. And hanging heavily over this vote, of course, is the cost of living.
I used to spend about 10,000 yen a week on groceries. That's no longer manageable. Prices keep rising, quantities keep shrinking.
Tokyo property prices are just too high. I wish they could come down a bit. I live alone, so I manage. But for families, I imagine it's really tough.
Prices are rising, but wages aren't. I really don't know how this might change.
Despite persistently stagnant wages, a weak yen, and inflation, Takaichi's first months in office have been dominated less by policy and more by performance. That mantra, work, 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 in her acceptance speech when she was chosen by the ruling party to take office in October, helped cement an image of relentless energy. In just over 3 months, she's built a striking public profile, from hosting Donald Trump within a week of taking office and announcing a new golden age of U.S.-Japan relations.
The first female prime minister in the history of Japan.
To their joint appearance aboard the USS George Washington in Yokosuka, fists in the air, as Mr. Trump showered her with praise. 2 days before the election, President Trump endorsed Ms. Takaichi. There was also another viral moment, a surprise drumming session alongside South Korea's President Yi Jae-myung. Jeffrey Hall is a lecturer at Kanda University of International Studies.
Takaichi has historically high approval ratings. There is sort of an atmosphere of positivity about her being the first female prime minister in Japanese history, being successful at diplomacy. There is a large conservative group on the internet. They are able to make posts showing her in a positive way go viral almost every day during the election.
All of this unfolds under the historic weight of her being Japan's first woman prime minister.
I wasn't interested in politics before. It felt like it didn't matter who was in charge. But since Ms. Takaichi took office, I've started to think differently now.
We're both women. I have high expectations that she'll work hard. When women decide to do something, we get it done.
She's conservative, a hawk. The economy matters, of course. But when I think about my grandchildren, national defense is what matters. And she's thinking seriously about it.
One other issue looms large. Since taking office, Takaichi has energized diplomacy. But she's also managed to infuriate China. Relations deteriorated sharply after she suggested that Japan would respond militarily if China attacked Taiwan. Comments she has refused to retract. Domestically, the row has strengthened her standing. But critics warn that the economic fallout could be severe. Sanae Takaichi is expected to visit Washington soon after the election, ahead of a Trump-Xi Jinping summit, and at a moment of deep strain with Beijing. If she wins the majority, she'll enjoy a brief honeymoon period. But the reality of stagnant wages, a weak yen, labor shortages, and rising prices will hit very quickly.
Shaya McAleel reporting there from Japan.
It's 6 minutes to nine. Let's talk about the story of the week. Peter Manson and Jeffrey Epstein with our Saturday panel. Rachel Sylvester is the political editor for The Observer, and Kitty Donaldson is chief political commentator at the iPaper. Good morning to you both. Thank you for coming
in.
Can we talk about Parliament and the mood this week, Rachel? You get this with any scandal. It was a week of very, very high emotion, and a huge number of female MPs who I know you're speaking to felt this kind of disgust at what was going on, particularly people like Natalie Fleet.
Yeah, I think it's really important not to forget actually who really matters in this scandal, right, which are the victims and survivors of Jeffrey Epstein, and talking to women like Natalie Fleet, who was herself a survivor of grooming, just this sense of fury and betrayal at what Peter Mandelson did, but also the sense that it's all become about the men and power and politics. And actually, she was saying to me, we mustn't lose sight of what really matters here. And that was what was frustrating her almost most, that it had become a sort of chattering point in Westminster rather than something about the scandal of these women and girls.
And Kitty, you know of MPs that were crying behind closed doors?
Absolutely, because they were so frustrated at what they saw as the interplay between what Rachel's saying about frustration and fury and disgust at the poison, the plague that's spreading from Epstein towards the Labour Party. You know, they've been out on the doorsteps knocking and won this huge majority only for it to be seemingly derailed after 18 months because of associations with this man.
I was intrigued by something you wrote, I think a few weeks ago, about even sort of conservatives that you've been speaking to are saying they kind of almost want the Labour Party to do better, to give them something to oppose.
Yes, absolutely. The Tories know that, both Tories and Labour know that reform are the big enemy here, and the Tories need Labour to do better in order to kind of get the country back into a place where it won't accept populist policies. And ditto Labour, they want the Tories to do better so they can be back in the kind of centre ground.
Rachel, the tenor of coverage today is very much that Keir Starmer's time is up. And this isn't just a Westminster story, it's about who runs the country and about whether or not they can enact their programme of domestic reform. Is your sense that basically there are moves afoot to replace it? And if so, when might that be?
Well, I think, you know, everyone likes to say this was the worst week or whatever. And I think there is a really dark mood among the Labour MPs, not only because of the Mandelson-Epstein connection, but because it's sort of much more general sense that Keir Starmer just isn't cutting through, isn't able to explain what Labour's doing.
Was that your sense when you were with him in China?
So the interesting thing is, in China last week, he did seem on top of the thing. He seemed very above party politics, actually, and the business leaders who were there were really impressed by the way he was acting on the international stage. Then he comes back to the UK and he seems to lack a sort of political nous. And I think it's partly he's surrounded himself by people who almost don't want to bring out his values. He's a kind of human rights lawyer. Someone said to me in the Labour Party, you know, it's like he's a pescatarian who's been forced to eat dog meat. It's all about, you know, appealing to the red wall. And actually, he doesn't really show what he believes.
Yeah, it's just you're out there with the business leaders, because one thing that business was sold was a bit of stability. A lot of people say in the FT today saying, you know, the bond market have a wobble if there's any move to the left. How do you see that one working out, Kitty?
Absolutely, and I think that's partly what's holding Keir Starmer in place, is that his challengers, such as they are, wouldn't need to make the case for their succession, particularly Angela Rayner, I would say. Even when Andy Burnham, who seemed to the left of the party, when there were threats that he might come back if he was selected for Gorton and Denton, the bond markets threw a little tantrum. I think Angela Rayner needs to go out and make the case, either by making a speech about her economics and reassuring the market, or perhaps letting it be known that she would have a safe pair of hands as her Chancellor.
It is this, Rachel, the criticism of Starmer, which is that he doesn't have a North Star, he doesn't have a clear story. You're starting to see the consequences, if that is true, of that playing out in terms of Number 10's relationship with the Parliamentary Labour Party.
Mm. And there's a danger, to pick up on Kitty's point, that the Labour Party learns the wrong lessons from this Mandelson scandal, that they veer to the left and they veer away from that sort of centrist politics that Mandelson represented, to something, whereas actually this wasn't to do with his politics or his strategy, it was to do with his personal flaws and, you know, apparent alleged corruption.
You can read all about it in tomorrow's Observer, or indeed the iPaper on Monday, when I'm sure